Richmond. We long to get in and doesn't get to Richmond.
That's exactly right.
That's why we need to build this new Midtown Tunnel.
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'd like to, although we don't have a flag, I'd just like to still ask everyone to please stand to do the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible,
thank you all very much. I appreciate everyone making the journey down here to Portsmouth. This was going to be the first of, I think, several times we're going to move the CTB meetings outside of Richmond. I thought we'd start here, particularly because we had the Midtown Tunnel, the business agreement signed, and hopefully shortly have the financial closing by the end of this year. Then also to see the new APM facility that the state is involved with. We're going to see the Tide. Those of you who have not had the opportunity to see the new light rail, that has really been a great success. Numbers exceed dramatically what the original estimates were. But also for folks to see some of the congestion problems we have here. So I know Arbery and Shep and Hollis are very, very happy we're seeing all this firsthand. Although all of us from outside the area got here much earlier than you did, Shep. So.
Let me tell you that.
Secretary, I want to note for the record, I took the train, so Thelma will be happy.
All right, excellent.
The train to where?
Newport News.
Oh, good, thank you. And did you ride the bus?
No, I didn't go. I did the train, Thelma.
Okay.
Well, Thelma, we could have used the ferry, however, it only runs every half an hour. It only runs.
Soon it will be tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Miller.
Yesterday I was honored and pleased to welcome folks on behalf of Mr. Ellis and Mr. Lane. Of course, wasn't in our meeting yesterday, but on behalf of us, for y'all to be here. I would tell you the room we met in yesterday was far superior to this room because we had a view of a ship where you could reach out and touch it as it went by. And I said, that's what this region's all about, is its water. And literally, the ship looked like it was in the room as it went down the southern branch. But we're glad you're here, and thanks for bringing us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. I thought what we'd do as we start out, ask Carol to give you an idea of the itinerary for the rest of football today and for tomorrow.
Good morning. Obviously, we're going to start out with our action meeting today. The action meeting will probably end, I'm hoping, around 11:30, quarter of 12, and then we're having lunch with the HRTPO across the hall in the Admiral Room. At 1:15, we're going to leave the hotel, all of us on a group, in a bus, and we're going to start our series of tours. The first thing that we're going to tour is going to be riding through the Elizabeth River tunnels, downtown, east and westbound, and the MLK route with a project briefing on the bus. Following that, there will be a tour and briefing at 8 p.m. We will ride through the Elizabeth River tunnels, Midtown tunnel route. There'll be another project briefing on the bus. You'll arrive at the Eastern Virginia Medical School Tide Station and board the Tide. This should be around 3:15. We'll ride the Tide to Newtown Road, should get there at approximately 4:15, reboard the bus, and ride to the Intermodal Connector Patriots Crossing, Hampton Boulevard Project Area, and receive another project briefing on the bus. At about 5:15, we should begin our trip to Mr. Miller's home, where there's going to be a cocktail reception and stand-up dinner. We're planning to leave Mr. Miller's home around 8:15 and ride the bus to the Norfolk Waterside.
It's 8:15 p.m., not a.m.
Correct. Norfolk Waterside Festival Marketplace, where, weather permitting, we'll board the HRT Paddle Wheel Ferry for the return trip back to the hotel. Tomorrow morning is our strategic planning session. That session is going to start at 8 o'clock. We will have a continental breakfast beginning at 7 o'clock in the same room. So you will be able to have breakfast tomorrow morning before the strategic planning session. We will also be serving lunch at 12. We're hoping to have that meeting done by 2 o'clock, and you should have received the agenda of the different subjects for the itinerary tomorrow.
That's any questions?
Will we be in a different room tomorrow?
Yes.
So we shouldn't leave anything in here overnight?
No.
Any questions? Excellent. At this point, we're going to ask for public comments. Anyone like to make a statement regarding any matter on the agenda or not on the agenda?
Secretary Connaughton and members of the Transportation Board, my name is John Nibb. I reside at 1307 Lake Point Drive in Chesapeake, Virginia. My business is at Greenbrier Tower 2 in Chesapeake, Virginia. I'm here speaking both on behalf of myself, several of my clients, and as part of the leadership of the Hampton Roads Association of Commercial Real Estate. Recently, I've had some very informative meetings through the President's Council of H.R. Acre with Secretary Connaughton, followed with a meeting that we had with Dwight Farmer, and then followed by that with a meeting with the city manager of Chesapeake. So we've been trying to make sure that we are educated and informed on the topics before you. The agenda item that is of greatest interest to me on today's meeting is agenda item number 10, and in particular regard to the matrix system that has been worked out where you have a 300-point system that establishes priorities for projects in this region. One of the people that I respect, the person I respect the most about the transportation needs of Hampton Roads is Dwight Farmer. When I had a meeting with Dwight Farmer here recently and we were reviewing that matrix system, I asked Dwight whether he agreed with that system or not. And he paused for a second. He says, I totally agree with both the system and the outcome. In that regard, the number one rated project in terms of your 300-point system was the Midtown Tunnel, which is hard to dispute the need for that. The second highest rated was Dominion Boulevard. And on Dominion Boulevard, I see great importance for the city of Chesapeake, but also great importance for our region, our state, and our nation. It makes that critical connection between U.S. Route 17 that travels south into Florida and connects us with other seagoing ports. We are the critical link between U.S. 17 and Interstate 64. If you follow U.S. 17 further south, you'll see that it reconnects with I-95. So in many respects, you're connecting I-95 to I-64, which to me, from a national perspective, economic perspective, a port perspective, is critically important. We have been working on trying to get those improvements for many years. Frankly, as a resident of Virginia, it's a bit embarrassing to come from North Carolina with four-lane divided roadways, to have it funnel down into two lanes, then back to four lanes where one of my former clients, Walmart, widened the road with private dollars. Then it funnels back down to two lanes again and widens out again at Scenic Parkway, again with private dollars by one of my clients that developed the Dominion Commons Business Park and also provided the site for Grassfield High School. Then we narrow back down to two lanes again and hit a major tie-up at Cedar Road, another major tie-up at the bridge over the Intercoastal, and then eventually you can find your way back to the interstate. The one thing that I would ask of you today as I conclude my comments is that thanks to the gridlock that we often incur in Hampton Roads, many of the speakers who are going to be here early this morning are still trying to get here. I spoke to my friend Tim Kerr here, who spent an hour trying to get here from Great Bridge in Chesapeake. So the needs of funding for transportation in Hampton Roads are great. And this region is an engine for the entire state of Virginia, especially with our ports. Having good roads that connect us with other states, such as Dominion Boulevard into North Carolina all the way to Florida, is essential to the progression of the economy of Hampton Roads and the Commonwealth of Virginia. And at this point, I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much. Anyone else?
Secretary, members of the Commission, my name is Tony Thiel. I live at 605 Hollygate Lane in the city of Chesapeake, Virginia. I'm Vice President of the Chesapeake Alliance, and I'm an attorney with Wilcox and Savage. A longtime resident of the city of Chesapeake, I've become very active with the Alliance, which is an organization of business leaders in Chesapeake who are concerned and work to encourage economic development in our city and the region in sister partnership with other similar organizations. I'm here today just to, first of all, to thank you for your approval and funding of the Portsmouth Boulevard project, which is a project that the Alliance has come to view as absolutely critical to concerns we have about the development in Western Chesapeake. I also want to encourage you to try to assist in getting this project going as quickly as possible because of the critical needs. The background on this is that the Alliance many years ago, even before the Great Recession, became very concerned about what was happening in Western Branch, specifically in the Chesapeake Square Mall area, where a number of tenants had left us and where we viewed economic development as turning down. We had a study group, the city formed a study group, and the one really encouraging bit of news we got was the construction of the Portsmouth Boulevard project. It's important for several reasons. Most importantly, there are a number of projects on the western side of I-664, which are absolutely dependent on the actual construction of that. This will provide an opportunity for our city to have some growth in an area that hasn't experienced that. Secondly, that road is the gateway to Western Chesapeake and the gateway to the mall and the many business establishments in that region, hotels, offices, and an extremely large retail development. The city recently made a significant investment with the mall developer in building a cinema facility there that's designed to help jumpstart a turnaround in the area. But the most important critical factor right now for that area and our fellow citizens in Suffolk support us on this is to get that Portsmouth Boulevard construction project going and built as soon as possible. Not only will it bring construction jobs to the area, which are absolutely critical, those are temporary jobs, but it will jumpstart these other developments. When that road is built, other things will happen, other job opportunities will be created. Thank you very much for your consideration today, and again, we appreciate the efforts you've made in helping make this project a reality.
Great, thank you very much.
Secretary Connaughton, members of the board, my name is Eddie Russell. I live at 222 74th Street, Virginia Beach, Virginia, and I'm here today on behalf of myself, Russell Realty Associates, and other retailers in the Chesapeake Square Mall area. I'm a partner with the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles and a member of the Chesapeake Alliance. My background is that I was reared in the Western Branch area of what is now Portsmouth, was old Norfolk County, and for the last 20 years have devoted much of my time to the development of that area. Our family owns the fee under Chesapeake Square Mall and a number of other retail establishments in the area. We lease those facilities, and we also have raw land in the area. There's 2.1 million square feet of retail properties in this area, with another potential 750,000 square feet to be developed. And the development of that property is very much dependent on the connection of this very substantial area with the city of Suffolk's industrial park and the residential developments along that have developed along Shoulders Hill Road. This project is the number one priority for the city of Suffolk. It is a high priority for the city of Chesapeake. It is critical to the development that Mr. Teal just spoke of on the western side of the interstate. It's also critical to the 2.1 million square feet of retail space on the east side of the interstate because developers in that area, some of which are residential, have indicated that they're not going forward with their plans, some of which were to start this year until this road is connected. This project is fully funded. It has been around for a long time, and we ask your deep consideration in seeing that it's moved forward as quickly as possible. It really is critical to the future of this area, very high priority for the city of Chesapeake. On behalf of some of my tenants, I've been working with the city of Chesapeake since 2008 with the Economic Development Department, with the city manager's office, and others because of the difficulties that have been brought on by the recession. This road and any establishment of any residential, any rooftops in the area is critical to the success of the entire area, and we ask for your consideration and thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, Mr. Knott.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else? All right, this closes out citizens' time. And now we have the minutes of July 20th, 2011. Do we have any changes, revisions to the minutes?
We have approvals.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you very much. We'll do some of these other issues at new business. Woodrow Wilson Bridge, Mr. Lynch.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, members of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm here to, the first item I have to talk about today is the 495 Hot Lanes project for the proposal to remove the restriction on a half-mile section of high-occupancy vehicle lanes eastbound and westbound during the HOV2 peak period, and that's outside the beltway. The inside lanes of I-66 during the rush hour and westbound during the PM peak are currently restricted HOV traffic only. When we open the hot lanes in December of 2012, we'll have toll-paying customers entering and exiting those facilities on the left side. That's the current design. So we just need that restriction lifted for that period. We've done for that time frame to allow those toll-paying customers to enter and exit into the HOV lane, but then they'll have to weave out during that period. So VDOT's recommendation is for the CTB to approve removal of the HOV restriction to allow those vehicles to enter and exit in that area on I-66 that is currently HOV.
Any questions?
Yes. Move as approval.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
And the second item I have is in conjunction with the Woodrow Wilson Bridge project, specifically the Jones Point Park reconstruction was a commitment of the environmental document, which is currently under construction. The request is for authorization to enter into MOA with the National Park Service and Federal Highway to do additional work on the interior of the Jones Point Park lighthouse. Federal Highway is agreed to be the lead agency to funnel 100% of the funds for this work through our program. Again, our recommendation is to allow the commissioner to sign the memorandum of agreement to proceed with this work.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Goldman.
Mr. Lynch, is this one of the final pieces in this particular location, the Jones Point
area is immediately underneath and adjacent to the bridge.
Yes, sir. We have two contracts under construction, the reconstruction of Jones Point Park, which will be done this summer, and we also have the reconstruction of Telegraph Road that will be done. It's scheduled to be done in June 2013. We expect to be out of there a little bit sooner.
I move the approval of the resolution.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Ms. Lynch, thank you very much. Local assistance, Mr. Brill.
Mr. Secretary and members of the board, I have two items for you this month. The first is a request from Henrico County for industrial access funds to construct a roadway to a proposed Bank of America facility in the White Oak Technology Park. The county has requested the maximum allocation available under the program of $650,000, and staff recommends approval.
We don't have a Richmond member yet. I will just make a comment about that. They actually do have a candidate, but there were issues. They need to make sure there were no conflicts in the person, so they're working with the AG's office on that. So we have a motion on that, please.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much.
Our second item this month is a request from James City County for allocation of airport access funds to construct better access to the Williamsburg-Jamestown Airport. The county has requested the maximum allocation available under the program of $450,000, and staff is also recommending approval of this project.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the development grant.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Is there any provision in there in the airport access funds, like the provision in the economic access funds, that has to do with a percent of total development going on, or is it? Yeah, in the economic access funds, I think it's 150 unmatched, 150 matched, 500 unmatched, or. And it's restricted by 20% of the total development happening in the Bank of America.
That I don't know.
Is there anything that...
With the airport access, it's $300,000 unmatched, $150,000 matched.
All that. But there's no sort of...
It has to be access to a public use airport. In this case, this is a privately owned airport, but it is a public use airport. And the cost of the project is significantly greater than what that
sure,
is.
Sure,
James City's paying for it.
The other question would be, when we look at deals like or grants, or what do you want to call them, like the Bank of America one, do we sort of apply what I would call a but-for test? Meaning, you know, obviously government has a role in incenting businesses to do things they otherwise might not do for economic development purposes. But if they would do it anyway, then my view is government doesn't have a role if they're going to do it anyway. And so lots of programs that I'm involved with, we have what we would refer to as a but-for test. It wouldn't happen but for the incentive that's granted or given. Is there any way that we measure that or look at that or sort of get a sense for that?
I think that's difficult to measure. In the case of the Bank of America project, the proposed investment is $300 million on a 65-acre site. So for the investment of $650,000, which covers about half of the cost of the roadway facility, there's a big disparity there between what they're investing and what we're providing to.
You know, I mean, I'm glad we can help the project, but you got to ask the question, why does government do that if the private sector was going to do it otherwise? In the Newmarket Tax Credit Program that I'm chair of board on, one of the federal requirements is that we look at the financing, we look at the deal, and we say, if we didn't do the Newmarket Tax Credits, this deal wouldn't happen. They're supposed to get it over the hurdle so that it happens, as opposed to just giving the money so that the deal is better than it otherwise would have been. Of course, I guess the General Assembly has set these rules, not us, but it certainly, for my way of looking at it, certainly makes me ask the question, why are we doing that if it's not needed?
The only thing I was going to mention, Mr. Miller, is the General Assembly does set out the general criteria, and we follow through in our policies and programs. From several of the projects that I've participated in, you know, they put together packages, and quite often they're, I'm going to call them one-offs, but because of other limitations, then they look for other pots of money that then they can defray, so they end up being part of a bigger package to get to a certain amount that, because in some ways Virginia's economic development incentives are dramatically, if you just look at the straight economic development incentives, very low. So they end up then looking around to see other ways to end up upping that amount of money by tapping into these other funds.
I think, you know, and your point's well taken. I think if we thought Bank of America's op center was going to go to Charlotte, if we didn't do it, then that's a but-for test.
Yeah.
If we're just making it easier and it was going to be there anyway, and that's a subjective judgment, I understand that, but that's what we do in the private sector every day.
Yeah.
But thanks for your info.
Traffic engineering, Ms. Sorrell?
Good morning. This particular item has to do with repealing a speed limit that was set by the board. And the history for this is that there was an amendment in the budget bill a couple of years ago that was placed there for Louisa County because they had a school that they were building. And during the time of the construction, they wanted the speed limit reduced from 50 to 35 miles an hour, so they chose to go to the legislature to get that done. And the legislation directed the board to establish this particular speed limit. So the school is now built, and the County Board of Supervisors has written requesting that the speed limit of 35 miles an hour be lifted because now there's a 25 mile an hour school zone that with lights and all the appropriate things have been set on Route 208. And so in order for us to do an engineering study and see what the speed limit really ought to be, instead of just putting it back at 50, we were asking the board to repeal their 35 mile an hour speed limit through this section, and VDOT will do a study and we'll see what the speed limit ought to be.
I move the adoption of this.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. Location and design.
Mr. Secretary, Commissioner, members of the board, the department is requesting the designation and establishment of a limited access control route in Warren County in the town of Front Royal. The purpose of this request is to improve traffic flow to a future bridge across the south branch of the Shenandoah River. If you look at the last sheet in your package, you can see moving to the left of that sheet goes to the bridge, and the area requested for limited access is that quadrant circle in the upper left-hand corner. And this project will allow right-of-way to begin acquisition this winter. The bridge replacement is set or tentatively set for 2017. It's a 1941 bridge, and it is a restricted load bridge at this time.
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Davis.
This is one of the highest priorities in Fenton District. This bridge is in dire need of being replaced. It is the key access to Front Royal, Virginia. We spent a lot of time listening to the public because there's an busy intersection just before you go into the bridge. And this new quadrant design, we believe, will help alleviate some of the congestion at that intersection just before access to the bridge. There's been a lot of input. There's only one or two property owners that are still talking with us about it. But I would like to recommend to the board approval of this resolution so that we can move forward with planning to get this bridge replaced.
Right, motion. We have a second. Any discussion? Sir. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Thank you very much. And programming, Ms. Mitchell?
Good morning. I have two items for you this morning. The first item is our monthly transfers for the six-year improvement program. The list is a little longer this time because it does cover 2 months. Majority of the projects are moving funds off of completed projects or from projects that the funds are no longer needed on and moving to other active projects. Be happy to answer any questions.
Question on, let's see, page 2, there's a CMAC program, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, what exactly is that?
Is that the Richmond primary one?
No, it says NOVA air quality congestion.
Northern Virginia secondary, Gallows Road.
Yeah.
On-road bike lanes.
What are we doing there?
That is those various activities that the MPO has identified to help with the air quality conformity up there.
Does any of that have to do with motor vehicles?
It should not.
It should not, or it does not?
Those are typically travel demand management type activities and not purchasing any kind of vehicles. Those are set up as separate projects.
So we're not purchasing any vehicles here? You're sure?
99% sure, yes, sir.
I guess that's as clear as we can get.
What does RSTP mean, Mr. Chairman?
Surface
Transportation.
Regional Surface
Transportation.
It's Regional Surface Transportation funds that are provided to the five big MPOs.
Yes, Ms. Ellis.
Yes. One question for Hampton Roads. I noticed there's a line item here for $3.8 million for Norfolk Light Rail. I was wondering, what are we doing with that for a study? Exactly what we're adding compass.
Where are you?
The 8 mile 11 station. Be a new alignment there. So on sheet 5. HRT
that end
budget.
Of the less than 10%. Excuse me.
You're talking about the second entry?
Yes.
On page 5.
That's right.
What's the third entry, right?
Second entry.
Unfortunately, I don't know off the top of my head. Kim, are you or Adam familiar with that? Unfortunately, I don't have some detailed information. I can get that for you.
Okay, we don't have an issue with it. I'm just curious to know what.
We'll get you some more information.
You know, what was being done there.
Mr. Chairman, I would just tell you that the format of these reports sort of lends itself to asking questions that we might not ask. Because you know where it's coming from, but you don't know where it's going to. Pretty much. I mean, the descriptions in terms of how the money is going to be used are very general.
The
transfer to schedule project recommended by the MPO.
That would have had MPO funds that they're transferring.
I understand that. It was just sort of leads to, okay, what scheduled project? Mr. Rich said, our car, you know, I don't know that we want to change the report, but I'm just pointing out that as we're moving millions of dollars, we know specifically where it comes, what it comes out of, but we don't know specifically what it goes into.
Well, you got the donor project and the recipient project.
It's ambiguous.
The MPO, who has the authority to do this. I mean,
I'm good with it. I'm good with it. I'm just pointing it out.
Are you sure the MPO has that authority? Well, they're the ones who have the authority to do this, right?
With the RSTP.
We had that trouble in Northern Virginia. It's in the six-year plan. I mean, these are authorized transfers that they can make within the guidelines of the rules. So,
subject to our approval.
Yeah, subject to
all this.
Ms. Busher, do you want to?
And quite frankly,
I'm sorry I brought it up, Mr. Chair.
It's just sometimes you have citizens that, you know, may inquire. certain things, you know, so that's why, you know, we do the...
We can absolutely get you more detail, but this indicates that the funding is coming from the balance entry for that MPO for regional surface transportation funding, and it's going into an existing active project, which is the HRT project. So it's the MPO discretion with review with the district and the CTB member in terms of taking it from an undesignated balance to a specific project.
In this particular case, it's getting monies to complete the construction on light rail.
Yeah.
I'm in favor of it. I just was raising
that. So a piece of it's coming from the CMAQ balance entry for Hanson and from the RCP.
Jeff, it's another example of the fact that those of us in the districts do get consulted on all the changes within the district, and the at-large people probably don't get as much information as we do, because each one of these is reviewed in detail with me.
Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye. All those opposed? Thank you.
Our second item is an action, a resolution for your approval on the utilization of available federal funds and obligation authority. This is an annual resolution that we bring to you each year to be able to utilize what we refer to as bonus obligation authority, sometimes referred to as August redistribution, that comes from the federal government, FHWA. This year we requested approximately $68 million and have received $49 million in bonus OA. And we are recommending that the majority of the projects for VDOT be utilized for paving projects, and then there's one project recommended for DRPT for the VRE, Spotsylvania 3rd Track Commuter Rail Assistance.
Move the approval.
I have a question.
Second.
And
second.
We have a...
Mr. Rich? We have a motion and a second. Mr. Rich.
Now tell me again, where are these monies coming from and what are they?
These monies are coming from all the states who return obligation authority and are redistributed by FHWA.
States are giving up money?
Yes.
Why do they do that?
There's a couple reasons. One, they may not be able to use all their obligation authority, and then there are some allocated programs that if you don't use the money in 1 year, you return it and you get it back the next year, and that goes into the calculation of the free distribution.
How is it when we get this money? I think it's great that we're going after it and other people don't want to use it. We can't. How is it then redistributed? Does it come back to this board? Does the members here have some kind of...
Yeah. The resolution is basically delegating the authority to the Secretary of Transportation, because we have such a short turnaround time to be able to select projects and get them obligated before September 26th.
Next month?
No, sir, because we have to have the dollars obligated by next Monday, this coming Monday.
But then what are we actually thinking of using the money for again? Do we have it set out?
I recommend it. Ms. Buescher just handed out a list of, and I think it's approximately 16 paving projects and then one project for Department of Rail and Public Transportation.
Mr. Secretary, is this what we're going to use it for?
This is the recommended list.
Yes, sir.
Because there are certain requirements about when you can spend this. I mean, it has to be spent.
It has to be obligated, committed with FHWA by close of business Monday, and then the usual spending requirements are in place.
And if you see, most of this obviously is maintenance. And
yes,
one of the problems that we have had recently is due to the earthquake, the flooding, and Irene, as well as the projections for snow this year, that comes out of the same pot of money, obviously, as maintenance we do for emergency response. So what VDOT is recommending is to use this money for these various maintenance projects to make up for this hole that's developing due to emergency response. Is that correct, Mr.
Yes.
Mr.
Is that what you intend to use it for? I mean, if we delegate this to you, are you going to use it for these projects?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Question, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to understand the flow. The money gets we have access to the money or it comes to us 2 weeks ago, three weeks ago.
Actually got the notice late on September 9th. Yes, sir.
So tip, and you have a week, or 2 weeks.
We have a couple weeks, basically.
And that's typical.
Yes, sir.
So it's sort of unreal. You know, when I first read this, I'm like, well, you know, the primary thing that we do, in my mind, is not the speed limit on this section of road at this school, and, you know, it's allocating money and sort of transferring that authority to the secretary. You know, you've got to ask the question, why would we do that? Well, there's an obvious answer. And the answer is we have 2 or 3 weeks, not 2 or 3 months.
That's right.
So given that that's the schedule, I certainly understand that, and certainly we trust our chairman and the secretary to do what's in the best interest. So.
Sure.
Well, there goes my winter vacation in the Caymans, but go ahead.
You weren't taking it, so you're out.
$29 million worth.
That's what I wanted to comment on. I think we need to commend staff for coming up with a plan to take advantage of that, so you do it in a timely manner and get the $49 million. And then ask the question, are we ever on the other, have we been on the other side of this where we've lost federal funds?
No, sir.
So we can brag as well.
And I should, you know, this is there's two issues going on here. First was I give a great deal of credit to the staff for identifying this issue on the stimulus money. Because this year, which was different than us just strictly doing the, did we meet our federal obligations from the previous year, which is normally what they look at, and they look at them whether all the states have spent all their allocated money. That was the normal test. But this year, because of the stimulus, they had this requirement that in order to take the stimulus money, you had to keep on spending a certain floor of money, essentially maintenance of effort. When we started getting to this point where the reports needed to come in, Mr. Worley and the staff here at VDOT work with the DRPT and the aviation airports. Everyone who got any stimulus money went out and reached out and made sure that everyone had maintained effort. And actually found a couple of mistakes. In fact, mistakes that would have precluded us from getting this money this year. And those mistakes made at the federal level. They cleared all that up back maybe in August.
Yes, sir.
So when you finally got to say, yes, we have met this maintenance of effort, and states like Maryland, California, New York, how many states?
It was Alaska, Delaware, Idaho, Kansas, Maryland, and New York were not eligible to receive bonus OA this year because they did not meet the stimulus maintenance of effort.
So I kind of keep this in, you know, perspective. So, you know, we were actually, when we worked the board last year, we had to catch up on the ARRA because there were some tight deadlines. Our normal obligation authority was still hanging out there. And on top of it, we had to keep a certain maintenance of effort. With all those challenges, the staff met all that, and that's ended up in us having the opportunity to get $49 million additional dollars.
Mr. Chairman. Would you welcome an addition to the resolution that would just have you distribute after the fact what projects, if we do this again next year or the year after that, so that we'd be apprised of that? And if you would, I would make that motion that we just amend the resolution to just so you would give us a listing of what we spent the money on if we got this in the future.
Well, why don't you make the main motion?
I'm making the main motion with that amendment.
You got a motion on the floor.
Yeah, a motion on the floor.
Oh, do we already have? I'm sorry.
Yeah. He's making an amendment, so I'll second.
Is that all right?
I'll second his amendment.
Yeah.
Sirka? Who made the main motion?
I'm sorry. I missed that part.
Accept him in.
Okay.
Second.
Okay.
Second accepts the amendment too.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much.
Because I should know the answer to this. What is LMET? That's listed as one of these projects, and I have no idea what that is.
You got an acronym list.
I'm not a maintenance person.
She doesn't know either. I feel better.
Why you know? Since we don't know, I think we can put it to another
district. That stands for Cayman Islands.
It's in my district, but that's good. I don't like it. Okay. Thank you all. I appreciate it.
Mr. Lay.
Let me make a comment before we move to the next topic back on 7 and these transfers. In the Hampton Roads District, we've been encouraged to move them onto projects that actually get done.
Right.
So we're going to see these happen more and more, and that's a genesis for a lot of what's going on so that we get the money actually moving on projects to be completed and spent.
That's a good thing.
As it is. Yes. I just want to point that out. So that's why you see, at least I can say from this district, why that's happening.
Mr. Chairman, there's one other characteristic of this too, and that is it takes planning money to have these projects ready to go, which has to be put up by the state in effect so that when these turnarounds come, you have shovel-ready projects ready to go within a short time frame so you can take advantage of them.
Right.
I know on 81, we were sitting here laughing a little bit. It's a mixed blessing for us. We got quite a bit of repaving that's going to be done, but you're going to be sitting on 81 waiting while we do it. But it needs to be done.
Yeah.
So we're thankful.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Another comment. I think I'm going to second what Mr. Lane suggested, that given the uncertainty that seems to be a permanent feature of the federal government in this area, we're more likely to be actually responding in this very flexible manner as opposed to proceeding simply in a strategic allocation of funds once a year. So I'm very pleased that VDOT is showing itself to be flexible and responsive to what's likely to be the volatility of the federal budget going forward. And all of us need to help each other out on that as well. I mean, keeping projects moving forward in this time is going to be a continuing challenge.
Yes. Okay, Policy Division, Mr. Walton.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, item number 9 is basically a housekeeping matter. As you know, this past session, the General Assembly changed the name of the Commonwealth Transportation Commissioner to the Commissioner of Highways. This resolution, the board would direct VDOT to make the necessary changes to the CTB regulations in the Virginia Administrative Code to reflect that change. That's all it does.
That's what that big bush gave us to read. That was all that was about.
We just finished it up this morning, too.
There's a quiz at 1.
Still moved, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. Financial planning, Mr. Lawson.
All right.
Good morning. This morning I want to bring to you a small presentation related to the Virginia Transportation Infrastructure Bank before we get into the action on that item. You want to see Ken's getting that fired up over there? I want to start by saying this program has been eagerly awaited and anticipated. There was significant work put in last session through the governor's plan to provide for this infrastructure bank. It is a revolving loan fund that will be... You're going to show it off your shoulder, sir. In putting this loan program together, there has been a tremendous amount of input and effort from various parties. I do want to thank Arthur Anderson from McGuire Woods. He's here in the audience today. He serves as bond counsel for both you, the CTB, as well as for VRA. And I think I've got VRA representation on the way here, but they're stuck in traffic.
You're not supposed to say that, Mr. Long.
Well, you know, I'll speak the truth.
I'll be on Dominion Boulevard.
The Infrastructure Bank was established by Chapters 830 and 868 of the 2011 Acts of Assembly. It is a revolving loan fund. It's created as a component or a subfund of the Transportation Trust Fund, and it with its original capitalization was $283 million. Which about $33 million came from the 2010 general fund surplus, and $250 million was provided from the Commonwealth Transportation Funds. The Infrastructure Bank will be overseen and managed by the Commonwealth Transportation Board and DRA.
Sorry, before you go, I just want to mention that with the recently announced surplus, you know, the governor intends whenever we get one-time money like that to place in the VTIP. So we have $60
million?
$60 million from this surplus that he's going to recommend go into the VTIP.
Okay.
So we'll have $340 million?
$340 million.
Yeah. And that, those funds will be included in the upcoming governor's budget, which would then become available in July of next year.
And one of the things we're going to be trying to look at is whether we can get an automatic, right now when we get a surplus, we have to have it reappropriated to us. To have it, when there is a surplus, it gets deposited right into the VTIP.
And in the administration of the bank, and I'll speak more to this as I get through the presentation, but the board, CTB, is considered the policy and programmatic administrator of the program. VDOT staff will be your staff in managing and carrying out the activities of the bank. VRA will serve as the manager, the financial manager of the bank. That role was established in the legislation, and they will play the key role in assessing the financial component of the loan request and the applicant's credit worthiness. There's a management agreement. It's included in your package. That is set forth in the enabling legislation. It's a three-party agreement between the board, the VRA, the manager, and the Secretary of Finance that kind of outlines the programmatic components of the program.
What's VRA again?
Virginia Resources Authority.
That's an existing thing, right?
An existing body within the Commonwealth that manages revolving loan funds for wastewater management and other state entities.
That's for any agency across the Commonwealth, is that correct? They would manage.
They have that ability, yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Colbeck.
Mr. Lawson, have we gotten to the point where we know whether and how many VRA additional employees will be involved here? Will there be a manager plus additional staff, or we haven't gotten to that level of detail about actual programming?
In terms of VRA staffing requirements, you know, that's going to largely be driven based on the volume of applications. At this point, VRA is going into the program, you know, with a staff in hand, and will assess as needed.
Second question, Mr. Chairman. And so VRA will pick up those management / administrative expenses, or will some of those come out of this bank fund or other VDOT sources?
Yes, it's kind of outlined in your package, and I'll speak to it a little more later.
Okay.
But there is, as part of the management agreement, and it was established in the legislation, the VRA will charge a fee to the bank to cover their management oversight costs.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Dr. Davis.
What is the typical group that's going to be asking for this money? Will it be a county, a city, a VDOT? Who's asking for the money?
The intended applicant will likely be local government. The funds are available, and I'll speak a little more as I get into this about that. If you want to just hold on as I work through the slides.
So you intend local government to be the primary
applicant? I would expect local government to be your primary applicant, yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Keene.
I understand that there are ways that grants can be provided through this program in addition to the law?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's not revolving.
Grants don't revolve. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I have one other question. As I read through this, I'm very impressed with the detail and the work that has been put in trying to match the legislation that created it. I'm just a little worried that the bureaucracy and the process itself begins to look very cumbersome. And I wonder how quickly we expect these loans to be made based on the time that somebody applies and how long it will take them to get together all the things that are required to be able to get a loan. I just worry. I know we've touched base and we've met all the legislative requirements. I can see it running all through it. But I just worry that this is going to get very complicated and very difficult to meander through. And does staff have any concern about that at this point? I wonder if we've over-described for the group that we're going to be dealing with, which is local government, which will have a hard time working through this process. I just share that concern after looking through it all.
Well, part of the thing of the challenge is because the statute did turn over administration of the program, quote unquote, as our manager, BRA. So what you see is almost duplicative of what BRA requires. Is that right?
That's true.
Tools are.
Very true.
So
this is working pretty well.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, when I was in Prince William, we used BRA fairly often. And they were pretty good on the loans, as long as it was a valid loan. And I think because we have local governments backing a lot of these, or it could be their IDA or something like that, they know how to do this. They know how to apply under the VRA guidelines today. And I want to say that it's a little bit different than going out dealing with the private sector on this. The fact is, you know there are political subdivisions, you know what the ratings are and whatever. So I'm hoping we're going to keep track of this. I mean, we one of the things is that our hope is everything works perfectly and we approve these guidelines today. They become effective in 60 days? 60 or 90 days?
15 days after they get through the APA process. Okay.
So if we get it, that our hope is that we already have like Dominion Boulevard, we have some others
ready to go,
have them start to move through the, at least get the packages together. We really would love to have some of the loans approved before the General Assembly comes in January. Mr. Rich.
This is kind of a follow-up to Dr. Davis. Have we put this out for some kind of public comment? To the localities or to the private sector to get their feedback on them at all. This hasn't been vetted anywhere outside of the staff.
That's correct. This has been worked through staff, both at VDOT, VRA, Bond Council.
But it will be published now.
It will be published as a part of this process.
There'll be a public comment period.
Yes,
that's right. Right now, 60 days
would be brought back to us for revision, or how does that work?
If there are significant adjustments, we would have to bring those back to you. Yes, sir.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Lane. I'm sorry, Ms. Lane and Mr. Miller.
Follow up to Dr. Davis's comment about timely submission and working through. There's also the point where I went through. I didn't see anything about timely execution once we award it, because it is a revolving fund. We want those funds to come back in and what have you. And I didn't see a lot of follow-up on the operations once we award it, if there were standards. Maybe it's all went from part of the grant or the loan that we give, that there'll be certain time limits they have to hit, because the last thing we want is to put some money out and then nothing happens.
Yes.
Following up once we get the money out.
That's a very good point. We have a situation like that in programs administered by the Federal Home Loan Bank System, where we award grants for affordable housing. People get the grants or get the loans, sit on them, and then when we're audited, we get criticized because the money's not turning.
Yeah.
And so this would encourage us to put some type of.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, does BRA have certain guidelines for that when they do this or no?
In terms of the use of the funds, I'm not sure. One of the selection criteria that we use in scoring is the readiness of the project to move forward.
Yeah.
That was one of the keys.
And
part of the process is also that we wouldn't actually disperse the monies until they're incurring costs. So it's not like we would hand them the grants just to, or the funds just to set up.
In my couple of years here, accountability, once we authorize something, seems to be something we're not very strong at in transportation projects. So I'm only encouraging us that once we set this up, that we consider that, and maybe we can start this one off
the loans could be just a supplement to a bigger pot.
Right.
That if somehow that money doesn't materialize,
and then what do we? How do we foreclose? What do we get our money back? That's the type of stuff.
So we'd need a strong set of contractual terms that relate directly to that.
Yeah. I think again, I mean the main party who's going to be applying will be a locality or a political subdivision.
Yeah. Right. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms.
Ms. Lawson, I didn't see in the package, and I know we're getting ahead of you on the slides.
Way ahead of me.
But we read it, so that's a good thing. Two things I didn't see, and maybe I overlooked them, but one was what's the criteria for determining grants versus loans? Number one, and. Is there sort of a bigger question? Is there a proportion of the total fund? The loans can be repaid over 35 years. That's a long revolution. You know, that's a long time. So if we went to the well tomorrow and we gave $350 million in loans to people, then we wouldn't get the total $350 back until potentially for 35 years. So do we have some sort of guideline, or is there something in the program that says we're only going to obligate a certain percentage at any one time so that another project that comes along 5 years from now could use some of this 250 or 340, in this case 350? Or is that, I'm interested in proportion of grants and criteria of grants, and I'm interested in proportion of total fund that may be on the street at any time, because we could do a lot of work, and maybe that's the way we ought to do it. Maybe I'll do a lot of work right now, and when the money comes in, we let it build back up. Mm-hmm. That's certainly the fastest way to get it. But it sort of begs the question that there may be a project 3 years from now that's really important, but we don't have any money left because we obligated it all up front. So is there anything that sort of helps us with that?
Mr. Chairman, one nice thing is surplus is our plan to go into it, so we'll be growing. Be a growing fund.
Yeah, and let me just touch on that for a moment. I'm sorry, there's coffee finally in the back. If anybody from the board wants some coffee.
So I'm really interested in, what's the criteria of grants? Is there a proportional issue there? And in terms of distributing funds or loaning funds, is there any thoughts on it?
Mr. Miller, let me take a whack on it, Mr. Lawson. The issue on grants. We've been told by almost all the financial advisors looked at this that we should at the initial stage make loans with whatever corpus of funds we have available. No grants the first tranche of money out. The reason is that then when we make the loans, we'll have revenue streams coming in, but then you can meet. If we give a grant, it's gone.
It's gone.
If we go out and give $350 million worth
of loans...
It's
like spending your interest instead of your capital.
And that's exactly what they recommend we do. Now, the interesting thing about that is once we create these revenue streams, we can use those streams for guarantees. We can use those streams for potential leveraging on bonds, on loans, other loans. And... we could use those for pledges against other types of leveraging. So what we're going to be recommending, what we'd like to do is see the first corpus, we go out in hard loans, and then we start getting the revenue streams, then we start taking some of those streams for some grants, and then use for loan guarantees, leveraging, and whichever. Then we'll have, the whole purpose of doing this thing was not just simply to give out a loan and get money back, but then to take a corpus of money, and if you got a good financial advisor, VRA understands this because they're doing the same thing, you can turn $1 into $3 to $4. Now, one of the things with VRA that we've been working with, and Mr. Anderson, he knows about both sides of this, is, depending on what the project is in the locality, it can fit, we can have them issue bonds to leverage off of this. This is one of the things that took us a lot of time to work through this issue on bonding and how we could potentially set up a reserve account for a bond and then issue bonds off of it. For a locale, we can't, the BTIP can't issue bonds, but DRA can. And like certain projects can qualify, and this is one of the things that we've been working with Dominion and Chesapeake on, that it could potentially meet the AAA bond, which pool that VRA issues. This is one good thing about VRA, is it makes us eligible for getting in their AAA pool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when they just sold bonds this year, it was 2.8% interest. Is that right, Mr. Anson? Yeah. So, I mean, we have them, I mean, we're looking, this is what took us a lot of time working through each one of the opportunities that we have with this money and how do we turn $1 into $3. And that's
great.
What
we're talking about. That's great. I mean, I applaud you all for what you're doing. And I guess I'm trying to, I was just trying to get some sense. And to me, if you, from my way of thinking, if you thought you were going to have recurring revenue of some substance coming off the surpluses, hopefully, then it would probably make some sense to get as much out there as you could, as early as you could, to get the impact of it and not have large amounts of capital reserves, if you would. But I just didn't know what your thinking was in that regard.
And let's just say, like, we went the VRA route on them leveraging and issuing bonds on our behalf. I mean, there we essentially set a reserve, a bond reserve, that they issue the bond so the bond holders have to know that they're going to get paid something. When you do that, then there is opportunities to also use that reserve for other things as well. So it is all about leveraging of what limited dollars we have. And again, one of the things we were hoping is that we can make this thing all work and we can get some loans out by January and can show the value of this. And I think Dominion Boulevard, I know there's folks here from Chesapeake, I think we'll have a real opportunity there to show them, folks, how you can really leverage money. And
great. Thank you.
All right. I think I'll touch on touch on the grants a little bit as we get through this, as well as the who's an eligible borrower. The eligible borrower, as defined, can be a private entity, a governmental entity, or a combination of bodies that are created by governmental entities or units. You see it defined here. To be a private entity, for a private entity to be eligible, they must be engaged in a P3 within the Commonwealth. But they must be engaged with a public-private partnership related project for a private entity to be eligible. Grants, as the question came up, grants are only available to governmental entities. Mm-hmm. And a grant, we cannot grant more than 20% of the amount that's been capitalized within
that.
The bank.
I asked that question. You already gave me the answer. I apologize.
In terms of loans, the legislation does set out that loans do require repayment of principal within 5 years of substantial project completion and final maturity not more than 35 years of substantial project completion. So technically you could have a 40-year window there. Loans ought to be repaid with interest. The legislation does suggest the interest rates be tied to or reference current market rates. In developing the program, VRA has set a base rate to be the AAA MMD, and we do have make provisions and they're in the application process to seek and negotiate rates that are even below what the AAA MMD would be. That's our benchmark starting point. Over the life of the loan, there are some required monitoring and reporting requirements that will be done by VRA and VDOT.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lawson, you said that it could be a 40-year. Couldn't it be more than 40 years? I mean, the five and the 35 aren't added together. They're all based off substantial project completion, which could be 10 years. That's substantial project completion, so you could have a 45-year repayment.
From the date of the actual
from
loan
the date of the
to
loan.
Completion.
Right. Gotcha.
As I mentioned, the management agreement is the document that's in your package that kind of outlines the program and the responsibilities of the CTB, VRA, and the Secretary of Finance. The other document in your package is the VTIB overview guidelines and selection criteria that kind of define how the program will operate. It includes an overview of the legislation, identifies, again, the interaction between CTB and the VRA, provides the process that the applications will be handled through, screening criteria, the scoring worksheet is in there, as well as the role of the VTIB advisory panel, which is intended to be chaired by the Deputy Secretary of Transportation, and you see the members there. This is a very similar arrangement to what we have with the Transportation Partnership Opportunity Fund.
Mr. Lawson, I'm sorry. Yeah, the question that I had as I read through all this is that it seems once this is enacted that we at the CTB level are really advising consent at that point. And really, we're not as involved in the process. And is that really the case? And if so, how much detail are we ever going to get into the applicants? Or is it going to be, here's the recommendation of the panel, and we pretty much go along with that at that point, relying on their background check and expertise? Or are we going to get into more of the whys and wherefores of the applications? That's where I was confused. As I saw, we could be a very limited role, which is how I read it, as opposed to going back and somebody applies from Hampton Roads and Aubrey and Shep and Hollis go back and really get into it and kind of explain things more from their perspective, or is that really being left all to the panel?
Sure. Page six. But then, do you want to say?
If you look here on page six, it kind of talks about the responsibilities of the board. You see there on the bottom of the page, to serve as coordinator of the statutory, regulatory, and programmatic changes kind of the program itself.
Number two
there being to consider applications recommended by the panel. Kind of what was envisioned here is that, VDOT staff and VRA staff are going to go through these applications, flush them out, score them, they'll be presented to the advisory panel that I mentioned earlier, and then the panel will make a presentation to you of each application, what was found, what was not found, and along with our recommendation. Certainly we can, adjust that program to have as much involvement, as needed, but that was the intent, is that we would...
I would just envision that, just as we do with the funds we were talking about earlier today, that the district representative be pretty involved in that to a great degree, and maybe this is getting into too much detail, but if we are going to be asked to ultimately make the award, then the procedures outlined would give us enough time. So it's not just the presentation of, here's the panel's recommendation today, we'd like your consent. I mean, and that goes back to my original premise of how much involvement do you, Mr. Secretary, really expect of the board? And the devil is in the details, but I would like to know when we try to roll this out, which I think is going to be critical to its success, that we can explain to the public and in our districts our involvement as a CTB member.
Yeah.
Well, I think the way the statute's set up now is that, I mean, essentially, on the financial side, it's quote-unquote staff-driven, but from the policy and the project approval side, it's a CTD. Now, one of the things when we originally were working with them on this was the General Assembly about whether this should all be internal or whether the CTB should be involved. And one of the things that originally we did not recommend the CTB because we knew there were going to be non-highway projects that the CTB normally would not be involved in at all. I mean, we already had some inquiries from aviation. We've already had some inquiries from the maritime. And we've already had some inquiries on the space facilities. So these are things that, I mean, but we went down this route because, you know, it seemed that, you know, the General Assembly did not necessarily want to give whatever executive branch complete control over the funds. So you're the last eyes and ears of the projects, but it's going to be very difficult in this Korzynski because it is, you're going to see loans of things you've never seen before.
That's what I was concerned with.
Yeah. So if you think about it, I always looked at this as we're the bank staff going to develop this whenever you're the loan committee, and you can get into it as much as you want or as little as you want, but the thing is that at the end of the day, they're going to ask you for an up or down.
It's always nice to be an at-large member.
It seems to me that our role, CTB role here, would be much like in all other aspects, policy and guidelines, and very little operation.
Approval.
Except final approval.
And final approval.
Final approval based on what is worked up by staff and recommended by staff, just like so many things that we do.
Gentlemen, I want to make an observation. One of my initial hesitancies was actually looking at the makeup of the advisory board or the advisory committee, that it's all public officials. And would public officials be as sophisticated and as knowledgeable about the type of instruments that we're talking about? For example, credit enhancements that can leverage monies up to 30-1, for example. But if there's that's kind of a specialized thing. But what I did was I just Googled the Virginia Resources Authority. Actually, their board of directors does contain private sector members from the financial community as well as public officials. So that I've satisfied myself on that question. I do have a question further, though, that you might want to raise is, given this additional authority, given the additional subject matter, should someone from transportation actually be on that board as well?
On VRA?
On the VRA's board.
Yeah, in fact,
given that the project mix is going to change and include now transportation projects.
Yeah, by the way, it was sort of interesting. VRA purposely reached out to us to ask for, at least from the private sector, a transportation person.
Yeah.
That's why David Branscombe, we recommended David to be on it because they had no expertise. But we can go back and ask about, you know, potentially having somebody, even from the CTB on it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all going to be, as we go through this, mm-hmm. I mean, it's we're going to live and learn a little bit, and I mean, we're very open as we work through this process and to make sure we don't become too bureaucratic, and but on the other hand, making sure that loans are solid loans, because the whole program is going to be dependent on particularly that first tranche. How much money, how much we're able to leverage that first stream of revenues and use it for these other purposes is really going to define our ability to, in the future, really build this into something.
Mr. Chairman, do we have any role models for this? Has it been done elsewhere?
Not really.
Success.
Not really. Most of them have been straight. I mean, TIPIA is the closest thing.
There are some models in the environmental side. They've had some revolving infrastructure.
And VRA.
VRA
is revolving in how they do things.
But so you referenced TIPIA, but correct me if I'm wrong. I thought that largely handled very large projects, a few large projects, rather than a number of small ones. And I thought the intention here was try to have a package of large and small to get diversified portfolios.
Yeah, and I think if you've already seen, we've already had the one, it was like a $30 million, where it's issues with Loudoun County paying back on properties. They've already got commitment. They got the money. The issue is putting the money up front.
We have some airports who have been talking about for hangars and things, borrowing from this and coming back in. So it's everything from Dominion, which is a bigger project, to some of these very small $5-20 million.
I apologize for being late, if you already covered this, but do we have sort of a model in terms of how many and what scope that we're looking at then identify that?
You know, quite honestly, we've had this discussion about how to take applications in and whatever, and, you know, we don't want the money sitting there.
Right.
So it is essentially going to be first come, first serve, look for the most valid loans that we can guarantee revenue streams to leverage.
Yes. All that. Where's the $280 million now? Is it invested? Is it in our bank being invested and earning what little bit of interest? Or
Yes. It's in the. There was created a sub account of the Transportation Trust Fund called BTIP.
So it's being actively managed right now as far as earnings potential.
Yeah. Where do you take your TTF money?
All of that's managed through the Department of Treasury.
Okay. So
and they have one make sure investment guys.
Oh, we're getting our act together. It's at least earning a little bit of something.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Richard.
I understand this type of concept is pending at the federal level. Ironically, it's kind of more controversial for the conservative than it was a kind of a brainchild of Congresswoman Rosa DeLauria, who said it wanted, her motto was Fannie Mae.
Some of the
conservatives were concerned that somehow we need to have guidelines that prevent that type of problem. Have we talked to any of the federal officials about what they're doing?
What they're doing is not what we're doing. Well, their infrastructure bank is nothing more than a grant.
Right.
I mean, it is nothing more to get out of going through your normal formulas for infrastructure projects. If you look at what's been put on the table, they're essentially a grant program. It's not a real loan program. But what the conservatives and others have been calling for is an infrastructure bank that will do what we're proposing to do, to leverage money. But what has been proposed for this National Infrastructure Bank is essentially you'll put money in there, they'll determine who gets it, they may or may not charge any interest or whichever.
So. I think on the Senate side, I read about one proposal where they're outlawing grants. People say no grants, and in order to have skin in the game, the bank would only fund up to 50%, and that you had to guarantee a source of revenue connected with the project, whether it be toll money or something like that. Do we have that type of safeguard? Because I don't want this to become another Solander. Whatever the hell. Where the heck that company's name is.
California.
Solyndra. That's one of the things. Do we have safeguards to make sure that we don't have Solyndra? I mean, people taking this money and then...
Well, again, remember, the who has to apply is a public entity.
Or
one of our P3 partners. If it's a P3 partner, they come under us.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I would say that, you know, the concerns are real because these things have actually happened in the real world. But that's our strength has to be to set strong criteria, make sure that it's being followed, and this is harder, make sure people understand this is not a place to put their political agendas. This is not, do I like you or not? This is like real projects, creditworthiness, ratings, you know, borrowing. And so we need to tell people understand that this is not the normal political process. Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae got a lot of social objectives loaded into their financial calculations, which quickly led to some very difficult
things. What are our safeguards to prevent
It's got to be us. I mean, even in the Fannie Mae, I don't think they adopted policies or laws that said, and here's your other agendas.
No, they wanted their bonuses from the commission.
We have to exercise
it.
Yeah,
so that's the oversight we can bring, I think, and constantly return to the real purpose of what we're attempting.
We have to be bankers.
And again, you know, you've got to remember, I mean, because this is an interaction between us and BRA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, BRA has been doing this a long time. And one of the things that's interesting about BRA is, again, they their bonds and the way they're set up, some of their percentage of what they issue is full faith and credit of the Commonwealth. And that's why they're AAA, and that's why they're able to get enormously great rates. They have done an exceptional job in doing these types of revolving accounts. So we'll be working with them very closely. And obviously, you know, we would not recommend anything stupid to you. I mean, our issue is trying to leverage transportation dollars. And then you think about this on the backside of this, we're creating revenue streams which can be reinvested. But secondly, we're getting transportation projects that might not have otherwise been able to move forward. And no matter what happens, we still have a transportation project that's been built underneath it.
One big difference in the model, Mr. Rich, that you're referring to, there's nobody being incentivized to make these loans. Where in Fannie and Freddie, they all got paid for making loans. I mean, we go through that in our... So
we don't get paid?
That's what I saw it here.
Love and admiration of your fellow citizens.
A profit motive, not, you know, I'm not saying there's not abuse, but there's a profit motive not inherent in our model, which is inherent in these other quasi-government.
Mr. Chairman, wherever you get a lot of money out there, somebody's going to try to make some money out of it. And I just want to know what our safeguards are. Does it have to have fit a match? How are the localities or the PPTA people going to pay it back? Have we pre-identified a revenue source? How do we know
that? That is a requirement in the application.
I'm far less concerned about what would be the financial side in terms of somebody doing it for wrong financial as the political side.
But I agree.
They want it, and let's do it. And even though we know it's a kind of a dog of a project and probably won't make the money, and what they're proposing is a good business
model, right.
We like it. Somebody calls me. I mean, we all get calls. You know, can you do this? Can you do that? From various, you know, whoever they are.
We're getting calls.
Huh?
We're already getting calls.
We're getting calls. And it comes down to just being able to rationally look at it and say, boom, this is a good project with a good financial return that will keep this solvent to go to the next one. And that's... Right.
See, I'm more concerned on the political side of when we start giving grants out.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, that's really where it's going.
Okay.
And that's where, honestly, now you asked it before about the interaction Ms. Korzynski did. The grants are going to come to this board. So, I mean, we have to safeguard the corpus and the liquidity and the ability to, you know, obviously make future loans. But, I mean, the grants are really where this issue is going to be. Where you're going to see more pressure.
Okay. Yep. All right, just moving on through the agreement here. We talked a little bit about the responsibilities of the board. I'll just move on to the responsibilities of the manager. And I think this is key to some of what we were talking about, is VRA as the manager, they're the body that's responsible for determining the structure of the loans and the financial assistance. And looking at that credit worthiness of the applicant, as Secretary mentioned, VRA has been doing this type of work for years. They're very good at assessing financial credit worthiness and structuring loan instruments. They will be the body that will actually coordinate the financial close with the applicant to actually release the funds and then to be the party to receive the funds back. Secretary of Finance's role in this is really supportive of the program to help provide for the needs of the budgeted goals of the bank in terms of what the governor includes in his budget to the Commonwealth, and to see that the funds are deposited and appropriated as needed to support the program. I did mention earlier where there is in the agreement a cost allocation plan from VRA that is used to provide for their compensation. And I'm happy to report that the agreement, as it's presented to you in your binders, has been found to be in acceptable form by VRA and the Secretary of Finance, and I would hope that you will approve the management agreement as well so we can move forward with that. We do have to provide copies of the management agreement to the Chairman of the House Committees of Appropriation, Finance, and Transportation, the Senate Committees of Finance, and transportation prior to any award of assistance from the bank. I want to speak a little bit about the guidelines and the scoring criteria. The enabling legislation does direct the board to develop guidelines for administering the program and to develop criteria that it follows the statute as well as other criteria that the board may find necessary, or the board and the manager find necessary in order to manage the program. The guidelines that you have before you in the document have been developed based on input from VRA and bond counsel and other staff. The narrative in your package includes an overview of the goals and objectives of the program, identifies who the eligible applicants are, the eligible types of projects, and types of assistance that can be provided. Talks about the application process and the minimum eligibility requirements that must be met in following the screening, and how we would disperse funds and then the required recipient reporting requirements. The chapters, enabling legislation, chapters 830 and 868 of the 2011 session, does require that the scoring criteria and the interest rate methodology be made public.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mark.
An observation regarding the scoring. In some cases, the least desirable objective is given a zero. In other cases, it's given a one. The pattern seems to be where there are only two choices given. It's given a zero. Sometimes you could give a zero to a two. Point being, that is weighting. Now, if that weighting is intentional and thought out based on some sort of a principle, that's okay. If not, it might be worth considering making all of the least desirables the same, zero or one or whatever.
Yeah, some of the rationale there was that the zeros, because when you look at a total score, you don't want to give a point for something that you don't want. So a one may be a least desirable, but a zero is almost like you didn't meet something you should have met. So there is a differentiation between the rationale between a zero and a one. I'd be more than glad to talk to you about that.
Do you ever think about negatives?
No, sir. In terms of the scoring criteria, they are, in your document on page 25. There are 18 individual criteria that look at are intended to be used to score both the applicant, the project, and the applicant's credit worthiness. Some of the examples of those criteria are looking at the maturity of the project. How far along is it, and how close is it to being ready to go? Date following some of the requirements of the legislation. It's looking for improvements to air quality. Does it provide safety enhancements? Does it fit in with some of the transportation plans and initiatives? And definitely looks at the recipient's credit worthiness and financial stability.
That's a point I want to actually get into. To me, that last one you have up there, the recipient's financial stability or creditworthiness, that's a pass-fail. If you're not there, it doesn't matter. All the other criteria, you could be perfect score, and you shouldn't get a grant. But the way this is up here, it makes me concerned that if you get perfect score on those and low on that, you can still get a grant, but then the bank isn't a bank. It gets to the issue of Fannie Mae. Well, we thought it was ready, and there's some air quality improvements, but it's not financially stable. I mean, if it's supposed to be a bank insolvent, shouldn't that be a pass-fail? First, you got to determine creditworthiness. Once you've done that, then you score it on the others, but it's an absolute score on that one.
Absolutely. The creditworthiness, and again, most of what we're dealing with are local governments. So
some are better than others.
And I think that's the differentiation. Some are better than others. I think you'll be hard-pressed to say some are totally unworthy.
Mr. Chairman?
Again, VRA is very versed in dealing with credit worth scoring of a...
You could get a community that could have a relatively good financial position. And actually, most in Virginia do.
but they could be taking on a project for which they are not the size, the scope, the cost, which is kind of a mismatch. This is the Fannie Mae problem, where somebody may have had a good credit rating and had an income of, let's say, $50,000 a year, right, but they got a loan that they really should have had an income of $80,000 a year. That, to me, that's got to be almost an absolute.
Well, you would think the BRA would weed that out, but I do agree with you 100% that if you're not, if the loan is too big,
yeah,
if it's too risky to give, it's, the rest of it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And but these are concerns that we're voicing now for the record to go back to VRA. I mean, some of the things that Cord just brought up, or Shep brought up, or Aubrey brought up. How do we respond to that now? Here's the agreement being formulated and the guidelines being formulated, and there are ideas that have been floated here that should be incorporated to the monitoring, the size of the loan, et cetera. We have to make sure that that gets back to VRA, and it's just not empty words that we're mouthing here, but our valid concern that VRA is going to do something about if ultimately we have the final decision.
I just want to point out, Sean Crumless from VRA is here, and he's hearing your words.
Okay.
And I'm certain as we get into that scoring process, and I think part of what we'll have is you know, we'll have a score based on the criteria we've identified. With that presentation of that application, you know, to you, you know, we'll obviously be able to explain to you the merits and the weaknesses of each of these applications. And just because it has a score doesn't mean you have to say yes.
Mr. Rich?
Yeah, I think to follow up on that, I think to make sure that we're not going to run into a Fannie Mae problem, if we have some guidelines, like I was reading in the Wall Street Journal, the conservatives that are thinking about putting together a bank are thinking about requiring that they have to have 50% skin in the game, and they must identify a source of revenue that to pay back the loan. But mm-hmm. you have that there so you can actually see it. And another point I'd like to make, I think Gary has brought up a good point, and I appreciate our leadership here are people of action that don't like to sit around. They want to get stuff done. And I think that's excellent. But I just got this material late yesterday afternoon. None of it has gone out to financial people or to the local governments. I think we're just acting too prematurely on this thing. I think we need to send it out a little bit and vet it. We ourselves just got this thing. I mean, I've had a chance to read it once, but something like this I usually read about four times. I'm not ready to vote on it. And frankly, until I get some more feedback from local governments and from financial people, and you see all these questions that are coming up. I mean, if I had had this a couple of weeks ago, but I think, you know, we are coming up right now at the spur of the moment with some very good ideas. And I'm not ready to vote on this, but I think this has been very, very helpful. I think we ought to delay a vote on this until next month. I was talking to some members from the General Assembly. And they were saying, well, we would have liked to have seen this before you vote on this thing. Anyhow, that's just a problem.
You're voting to send it to get published.
Public comments.
All right. You can't go and get public input, selective public input, until you publish the thing. That's what the whole purpose is. This is simply to adopt it to go to publication.
Okay. You'll bring it back to us.
Can we get another bite?
Yes or no? Why was this only sent out on Monday? Will you explain that to me?
It was last minute getting the materials together, sir.
I can vote to send it out if you promise to bring it back after we've had
it. Mr. Chairman, I think I think laid out in here we had another bite at the apple.
Yeah, 3 days.
So, Mr. Rich would be comfortable. I hope he'd be comfortable.
Yeah, if he comes back to us.
I just don't understand. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. You presented these materials to me. Why are we sitting here? It only went out 2 days ago. That's all I'm trying to understand.
I got it yesterday.
Yes.
Yeah, I got mine Monday. Late day, Monday.
Well, in any case,
Mr.
Rich.
If we can bring it back after
we've got another bite of the apple. Once we get a little bit more detail and some public comments, we'll come
back. Public comment and examine that. I would be comfortable.
We have a fail safe.
Okay.
I'm comfortable with that.
Ms. Lane.
One, on the criteria, actually I thought they were pretty good, setting on different loan committees. I would ask that we may consider, though, a lot of the, specifically someone from local government, some of these projects will be scored already by the MPOs or TPOs. And it may be useful just to get their scoring as additional information and as a check to see, hey, did they score the thing the same way we did?
They're not going to score it necessarily with the same criteria.
No, but at least we can get some idea.
Is it an important project to them?
To them and stuff. And it may be,
absolutely,
you know, just another piece of information
One of the required criteria based on the legislation is that the project be of statewide, regional, or local importance.
Right.
And that's clearly where, you know, your input and input from the MPOs can help define
and,
that.
And to take it out of the political range, you've got a score that has supposedly been agreed upon by this body. It may be very useful to us in identifying what's a political project versus something that the whole region has come together on. Yeah.
Except I just heard that the score could be a high score based on the other elements without the finance. Can you imagine we get a project and it's the highest scoring because of the other elements, but it's not financially viable?
I'm totally agreeing with you. If it's not credit worthy, we shouldn't be looking
shouldn't
at it.
Be, we shouldn't be here. Right. And I think that's the part I get cautious about is we get presented with a project that scores really high and it's financially unviable and we got to turn it down. And we'll just get criticized for turning down the highest score.
In the real estate world, I go through that all the time. You got a great project, no money.
But again, if up front we identify they have to have skin in the game,
right,
and they must identify the source of revenue to repay it,
right,
we won't get into that, really. Like Solandra said, oh, Mr. President, we're in great shape. We're going to be viable.
Yeah, on one hand, we're sitting there saying we don't want bureaucracy, we don't want to get into everything, we don't want to create freaking new staff with 20, 30 people, and then at the same time, I mean, for the most part, this is going to be focused on projects that are in your six-year plan.
Right, that's right.
And this is going to be about how do you make those those projects go by leveraging our money, where we don't just simply put the money into it, we actually look and say, okay, we're going to get money back through tolling or whatever. You know, we make those decisions as to whether it gets in the six-year plan or not. This is just one financial mechanism. It's a tool. This isn't, we're not Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. This has nothing to do with loan guarantees on large bodies of loans, you know, where they went and bundled thousands of freaking pieces of real estate and then, you know, guaranteed those. I mean, this is all about you're looking at a six-year plan for the most part, except for some other projects that are going to be aviation and because all transportation modes are going to be eligible for this. This is your six-year plan. You made that decision. Now you're going to figure out, do I put $100 million in direct cash? Or do I turn around and say, I'll lend you that money and give it back to me at 2% interest? You'll make that decision. Because that's where the main focus of these projects are going to be. I mean, Dominion Boulevard, I mean, we look at some of these other projects. This is just a tool in the tool chest. This is not the be-all, end-all for these projects.
Yeah, it's not a substitute process.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
I move the approval of resolution number 10.
Second.
Well, do you want to hear the rest of the presentation? Or no?
I'm glad to stop now.
Well, since they said yes, go to 12.
All right, just go to 12, and please, and Mr. Rich.
One question. We talked about bringing this back after the public comments.
Go to 12.
However, I'm looking on, I don't know what page it is, it says, this is at page 12, this becomes effective 15 days at the end of public comment. Number one, how can you analyze all of the public comment within 15 days if this board would not have had a chance? So I think that needs to be modified.
Well,
we need more time than 15 days after public comment period closes in order to rationally apply our susceptibilities to this thing. So
I'm ready to go forward. As I said, if we can bring this back, we're going to have to take out this 15-day thing and we can't get it back.
Sure, we can bring it back. We'll bring all the comments, too. All right, so, but understand what's going to happen. So we approve this. It goes to public comment. This board has the opportunity, I mean, and again, I apologize. We went over this a couple weeks ago. I thought that you all had this presentation of guidelines beforehand. We have 2 months, we as a board, to look at it. In fact, why don't we bring it back in October, and we can go through some of the, go through in a little bit more detail, October, November. Or actually, why don't we plan on November bringing this, so we'll see where the comments are.
We don't meet in November.
We don't meet in November.
Well, maybe we should. Maybe we should meet.
Well, because December we're going to be down here again. We can even do it December.
Yeah, we'll have a 2-day meeting. Yeah.
All right, because we're going to be here for 2 days. That will be just about 2 months, right? So we'll be able to see, really, for the most part, what the things are.
Is that going to prevent you from awarding one before the session starts?
Well, it's going to be close. But what we're going to encourage some of the applicants, like Chesapeake, is all, where's my Chesapeake contingent? Where's all my Chesapeake people? Everyone wave. There's all my Chesapeake. As you can tell, the Chesapeake folks are very interested in getting this thing moving. You guys want to start a wave? Start a wave. We were hoping they would be the first ones out. And so we're going to encourage them to start to maybe put the guidelines, as if the guidelines were in place, to go ahead and start to put their application in place. December, we'll bring this back. We'll go through all the comments we've received at that point. And, you know, I don't even mind even having a little public meeting about it. Why don't we do that?
Okay.
We'll have a little public meeting. We'll invite folks in. Now it'll be before the final, because if we get this thing published, when?
So that'll be October, November, December period, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry.
When would it be published?
We will submit it to the APA process now.
Right.
To get this.
So 60 days from when it's published, right?
The way the period, I mean, it's many steps it goes through, but there's a public comment period of 30 days, which is likely to start about 30 days out.
That's perfect time. So is that all right with everybody? What we'll do is we'll hold in December a public meeting as part of ours. We'll make it a part of the workshop, but also we'll make it for folks if they want to submit comments as well.
It will not have become final, right?
It won't be final until the comment period ends. If we have any, we can end up making comments, our own comments, to it and asking for it to be changed.
So it's 15 days after, what does this say? 15 days after public comment period ends,
we're extending the comment period.
He just
changed the guidelines. He said we're going
to... No, and so remember, we're controlling the guidelines. So if after we meet, so we got 2 months, or actually 3 months, to go through the guidelines. We have comments, whatever, and changes you want. Mr. Lawson is the man to do so. And then we'll have a public meeting, and maybe at that point we'll be able to list whatever changes we might want to make to it, and we'll take comments. I think this is we'll be able to get some, see what people think. And actually it's a perfect time, because if we do it in December, transportation conference, we'll have folks from all the modes. Yeah. And that might actually, I'm starting to think that maybe we'll actually have a session about this, not during the conference, because we're going through the agenda today, but during the CTB, we're planning on having a short meeting that morning. Maybe what we'll do is we'll make it a very short action agenda and spend a couple hours going through this thing. And that will be before the comment period ends. If we have any changes, we can just tell Mr. Lawson. And then when it closes, you have to republish if it's minor changes or substantive changes.
I think it will depend on the significance of the changes, and I'll have to talk with your AG's office to kind of validate that.
Okay. Is that all right with everyone?
Good work.
Okay.
Do you hope then to be able, if everything's approved, to make a loan as the first of the year?
If everything worked perfectly, there's changes that we might want to make. We already have changes right now. And again, you'll start the clearance process right now. there's changes, there's opportunity to make changes for the next 30 days. So if anyone has any issues right now that you see, Ms. Garzanski, particularly you've had on, you've seen some of these things on being on, you're a Fannie Mae, you're a
Federal Home Loan Bank.
Home Loan Bank.
But we're a GSE. Yeah.
Okay. We got 30 days as it's moving to clearance because it goes through the governor's office last. So we can try to get, we'll get things stuck in before it gets published. And then if everything worked perfect, let's say we're able to address any concerns, and we come into this thing in December and the thing comment period ends officially probably at the end of the month, 15 days later, there's the potential that we could have a loans at the end of January, February, which would be right in the middle of the General Assembly.
Mr. Chairman, when does the comment period end? I'm a little confused on that.
It's 60 days from when it's published.
60 days, is that right? This says 30 days public comment.
It's a 30-day period, that, but again, it's anticipated to take about 30 minutes to get to public comment as it gets its way through the governor's office, Department of Planning and Budget approval process. They have to go through an evaluation before it's put out to public comment.
Maybe what we need to do on page 12 is just take out 15 days and just say comes effective. I don't know. We just need to make sure that we...
Well, that's a legal requirement.
That's the requirements of the APA process.
But anyhow, the Secretary is assuring us that
we're good.
The process will be done.
So we'll make sure we get as much comment as possible on this thing. I mean, so much of the stuff that we're doing, a lot of it's our involvement is new. In reality, most of this stuff is kind of tried and true under the VRA.
The
VRA. Under what new VRA.
Mr. Chairman, can we call a question?
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you very much. I just want to ask Mr. Anderson, would you mind stepping up for a moment? We're paying a lot of money for our lawyer, so I might as well give him a couple of moments to say something. Could you just introduce yourself and... if you have questions specifically about the process, can they go right to you?
Well, the APA process, I don't claim any special knowledge of that, but yes, certainly. I'm Arthur Anderson with McGuire Woods. We represent the Commonwealth Transportation Board as your bond counsel, so we help staff and make presentations to you all about bond issues. Most recently, we completed a very large capital project revenue bond issue, about $600 million. And in addition to working on the VTIB structure, we are also working on the Garveys, which we're hoping to bring a resolution, an approving resolution to you in October. So, but I'll be happy. I have another hat. I also am privileged to be bond counsel to the Virginia Resources Authority, so I know a lot about their processes and helped coordinate putting VRA and CTB together in drafting the management agreement and the guidelines. So I'd be pleased to answer any questions of a more technical nature.
Sam, is there anything in this presentation you want to clarify or expound upon?
Well, I think one you were asking, I think a question came up about role models for this, and I really would, emphasize what the chairman said about TIFIA being a role model for this. These state infrastructure banks are created in many ways to be kind of a TIFIA on a state level. As you know, TIFIA for very large projects makes their classic form of assistance is a subordinated loan. So they'll take a second position if, you know, on say $50 million, make a $50 million loan, if that enables the project sponsor or the borrower to go out and borrow in the public markets $300 million on a senior basis. Now, the reason TIFIA can do that and the reason that perhaps VTIB can do that is that this money is, you know, equity in a way. I mean, many of the problems with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac came about because they bundled these mortgages together and sold them to the public. We don't have that issue here. We're not, initially VTIP is not beholden to public bondholders. It's got an equity pool, really, to make these loans. So when we score, you know, what I would envision is when you score the project, if you have a project that is really going to have a significant regional or statewide impact, but it can't all be done on a senior basis, you might need a subordinated loan to make it work. That might result in a slightly lower score on the financial feasibility, but you're going to, by making a, you know, $50 million subordinated loan or funding a reserve fund, as the chairman described, you may enable that project to get done because they can borrow the rest of it on a senior lien basis.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Is that anything else?
So anything else? You got the man, so. Any other questions?
How is he going to pay it back? Don't you usually know?
Well, and the General Assembly has...
General revenue bonds or something?
Well, it could be general revenue. It could be toll revenues. It could be proffers, an anticipation of the receipt of proffers. It could be tax districts, special tax districts, tax increment structures.
But you want to know in advance, right?
Well, yes, and that's part of the application process, and the General Assembly has said that when BTIB makes a loan, you do need a dedicated source of repayment that is in the statute. So,
and again, I just kind of always keep everyone focused on this. If they go belly up on the loan, and then they belly up on the bigger project, which means we get a free project.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I mean, any of these T3 projects go belly up, concession errors, whether it's Hot Lanes or Midtown Tunnel or whatever, we own it. So
we're half done, Mr. Chairman.
What's that?
We own a half done project. Then why? We got to put some taxpayer money in to finish it, right?
Well, no, I'm talking about. I mean, this when the projects get up. I mean, when you look at it, obviously, as the projects move forward. Well, I mean, you can look at it this many different ways. I mean, either we could be giving them the money straight up, $400 or $500 million to do a project, or we can lend them $400 or $500 million and have them write a return that we can use for other purposes. And if they still want belly up, it's still the $500 million. But we still get the transportation and infrastructure, either as the owner of the infrastructure as per our concessions, or as a lien holder due to the fact that we let them borrow money.
But it may take more taxpayers' funds to finish it, right?
These are projects that if we had the money, if we had unlimited monies, we would do. Sure. We're saying we don't have unlimited monies. That's what I'm saying. So now we found a way to leverage it. I don't see where the risk, I think it's actually lessened significantly because we've asked them to go out and find some other alternatives where the state would have bought, done the road all 100%. If it goes belly up, we've put in 25% or whatever, okay, we got to spend more money. We're going to build the road anyway if we had the money.
We're not like a bank, we're like a partner.
We're a partner. I mean, that's we're not a, you know, loaning money to third parties where we are simply the only ones on the hook. I'm having difficulty because, Mr. Richard, what you're saying, these roads need to be built anyway. They got to be built anyway.
We won't raise taxes to build them, so we're trying to do as much.
Trying to do as much as we can.
I just want to protect the taxpayers and make sure that.
I think we're all in agreement on that. Absolutely.
Sometimes projects fail.
Yeah.
They may fail if we gave them all the money to begin with. Well, that happens all the time. We come back and we say, we need another $50 million to finish this road.
Mr. Chairman, the beauty is we have input from VRA and some smart people. We have input from our staff.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we get to decide.
Yeah.
We can say no. So we really have more oversight and sort of more brain power coming to the table with the inclusion of BRA and bond councils and others than we may have if it was a straight, you know, six-year plan item.
And I really appreciate the chairman giving us more time to get more input from financial institutions or local governments. I think that would be very helpful.
Well, again, I mean, this is new for us, but BRA's been doing it, and there are other entities in the state government. And again, when you look at, go back to Mr. Anderson's one point about the fact that you would envision, just like, again, Dominion, use as an example, I mean, they're looking at us for one piece. They're looking at bonds and quote-unquote equity.
Their own money.
It's all how you mix a package together that makes a project financially. And this will always be a tool that, you know, you can imagine us potentially giving in, you know, a quote-unquote grant to go forward with a project and maybe doing this. And then they're going to have to bring equity, and they're going to have to maybe go private activity bonds. All of it put together a package that all of a sudden makes it much more attractive to somebody to invest, whether it's a locality or a P3 partner.
Mr. Chairman, I thought we had some cases on PPTA whereby when they get into the thing, and then they come back and say, you know, it's really not allowable, we need some more state funding. We've had that happen before. We've actually put additional six-year money into the PPTA project because they just need the money to complete the project. Am I wrong on that or right?
Yeah, I think you're wrong. I don't know of any of those.
I'm not familiar with it.
But even if that's the case, Mr. Rich, we can do that through another vehicle and end up in the same place. This is, again, just another financing tool.
Right.
The underlying sanity of the project and the underlying worthiness of the project are the issues.
No guarantees.
And we have that regardless of what tool we use to get there.
Right.
So I sort of look at this, I mean, I hear you, but I sort of look at this as we already have those risks. We have those risks in a six-year plan. We have those risks in a PPTA. We have those risks. This is merely a financing tool that allows those to occur. They might occur through some other tool otherwise. We still have the same obligation, no matter which tool we use. We still have the same obligation, and we have the same authority here to say yes or no. So it's just another arrow in the quiver.
This is all very
still shooting the apple.
And a great idea. Just don't want any more Solandras or, you know. That
no question about that.
See, I always go, again, and I always go look at this as even if they went belly up,
we got the roof.
We got, quote unquote, it's not free stuff, but we would have paid for the improvement anyway.
And I think it's, you know, I started down the road of thinking about it like a bank. It's not like a bank. We're going to build that road. We want that road built. We want that project done. We're already doing that. We're not in the market where we're just making loans. We're in the market of getting roads built. We already want that one done. So this is just a mechanism to get it done. And if we make a bad judgment, we could have made a bad judgment with a six-year plan. Same sort of
fully loaded. If you take the Dulles Rail thing, you know, you got to be careful on things like that. This isn't that big of a scope of money, but I mean, they're
no
running
question.
Out of money, spending too much, and their ideas is to raise the tolls on the toll road. So the money has to come from somewhere and has to be paid back. That's all I'm saying.
But isn't that issue either you want the road or you don't? I mean, that's not an issue of whether. We do. I mean, well, but you know, either you have the road or you don't. I mean, I guess that's where I'm coming from. What Mr. Miller said, either if, you know, you may have been against light rail, you may have been against everything, but the issue is either the decision is you build it or you don't build it. Once you've made that decision,
but getting to the secretary's point, if this is a tool, then right. The question is this the tool used for that project, or you use another tool?
That's exactly right.
That's straight out funding.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly
yeah.
Right.
And that's
what's the right tool?
Mr. Worley, you want to say something, and we appreciate it.
Okay. To the members of the board, I apologize that you didn't get this information timely. It seems like I'm almost promising it at the board member a meeting that we're going to do better, but I promise you we will get this information out to you ahead of time so you have enough time to review. Again, I apologize, and if you'd like to meet with either John or myself during the course of the day or tomorrow, we will be available to review any aspects of the program you would like.
Mr. Chairman, one last thing. I'm encouraged and excited that we're finding ways to do things that and to advance our transportation goals that we didn't have before. So I think we ought to take our hats off to the governor and the staff and so forth. And obviously been better to get a little earlier, but it's a good thing. It's a great opportunity to move some stuff ahead, and we need to find some more like this, or it'd be good to find more like this so that we can meet our obligation here.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Miller, after that comment, you're welcome to join me in the Caymans if you'd like to.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I
prepare your bag,
sir. Mr. Chairman, I want to second that, because the history of this set of discussions really goes back 20 years. The General Assembly has looked at this at least as far back as 1996, 97. I remember Jack Rust, who was a delegate, one-time delegate from Northern Virginia, was beginning to explore these things, because we could already see there was a mismatch between our revenues and what we thought were are going to be our obligations in a high-quality state. And so the General Assembly itself has moved forward steadily, but you and Governor McDonnell have actually put this idea not just on the table, but brought it through the process, and I think you ought to be commended for that. I mean, we haven't been as sophisticated as we could have been, and now we are going to be more sophisticated.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We're going to go to rail and public transport.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. Our first action item deals with the Norfolk train service. Mr. Garzinski, during your term, you're going to be able to ride a train all the way into Norfolk.
Yes.
This project,
I'll pick you up.
Thanks to you, is well underway. Construction is ongoing off of Tidewater Drive, where the train will be stored, maintained, and serviced. Also at Harbor Park for our platform, where Norfolk is building the train station and a multi-mobile transportation hub there, and also what we call the Collier Connection south of Petersburg, which is our connection track to CSX. In the course of the construction, what Norfolk Southern has discovered, and VDOT has worked very closely with us and determined as well, that we need to construct crash walls underneath 264, because the track is now closer, as well as under the light rail tracks. HRT has worked with us on that as well. And at Collier Connection, we've discovered some soil conditions that need to be addressed, and there's a little bit of additional track that's going to be built as well. So what we're here for today is to ask if you would waive the 30-day pre-briefing practice and approve $1,406,691 of rail enhancement funds that are unobligated funds to go into this project to allow for this completion.
Move approval.
I move approval. First one, Mr. Lane.
Move approval.
Second.
All those, any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Our second one is a company called Cycle Systems in the city of Stanton. What this is 725 feet of new track. This was briefed to you in July by Kevin Page, and actually you had approved this in September of 2008, but they were not able to perform because of the economic downturn, and so the funds were removed from the project. So they're ready to go now. They're back. This is a multi-material recycling operation. They do have a resolution from the city of Stanton. Virginia Economic Development Partnership supports it, as does Buckingham Branch, and they meet all of the DRPT criteria. Total capital outlay of the project is just over $2 million, and I'd like to ask for approval of the resolution.
Chairman, I move the motion.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Next one is Valley Recycling. This is just over 1,000 feet of new track in Augusta County. It's actually in Fishersville. And what this is the first time in Virginia that it's the Simon family. It's an affiliate of their companies. They're currently in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New York. This is will take, it's 10 additional jobs and 150 rail cars off the track. It's we'd like to ask that you waive the 30 days and approve the $375,000, which does have a local match of $75,000 for this project.
Mr. Chairman, from the Staten District, move approval.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
And the last one, Mr. Secretary, is Phoenix Packaging Operations. This is in Pulaski County. It's 1,300 feet of new track in the town of Dublin. And this is the first time this particular industry is in America. They are currently in Latin America, but this is their first manufacturing plant. They do packaging forms, designs, plastic packaging, disposable products for industrial and commercial use. It is 200 additional jobs and 400 rail cars, and I'd like to ask for approval of the resolution and the waiver of the 30 days.
Do you have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you,
Mr. Secretary.
Okay. Let's go, Kevin.
Secretary, Commissioner, Board, on July 27th, August 3rd, August 24th, the department took 42 bids. 38 projects were awarded by the commissioner per the board's July 20th resolution. Of the 38 bids awarded, 31 were under $2 million, 5 were in the $2 to $5 million range, and 2 were over $5 million.
And I'm sorry, the two here, I just want to make sure I understand this. So on the, looking at this Route 27, the one that Shirley Contracting?
Yes, uh-huh.
So we had in there $38 million as what our estimate was, and the bid amount was $31 million. So we're still seeing about, that was a 20% savings or thereabouts.
Mm-hmm. That's just a six-year plan. That's not your official estimate.
Oh, okay, so what is the official estimate?
I don't know offhand because it's a FOIA-protected estimate.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, on these bids, Mr. Camus, do we tell the bidders what our budget is?
No.
They know from the six-year plan, but they don't know our engineering estimate.
They don't know the blind estimate.
Okay, good. So we're not letting them. They know they can go the six-year plan, but they don't know what our engineering estimate is.
Correct.
Okay, good. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Lee.
On this Russell County project, 78819, why was that rejected?
It was too high. The bid was too high. We'll rebid it.
Sorry.
It was too high. The bid was higher than our engineer's estimate.
Is it going back out for rebid?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
One quick thing on the bidding process and the estimating. If due to the fluid movement in the economy right now, I mean, how often do we update our estimating process? So that we're getting, in other words, if we're estimating an R&D, our estimate anyway, it being $5 million, and the bids are coming in, you know, it's $3 million, $4 million, something like that. And it's great that they're coming in that low, but do we go back and reevaluate why we were higher than what these current estimates are? Because, again, it seems like it's something that needs to be adjusted with the economy as we go. Instead of just having some set criteria that stays the same no matter how it, I just wonder how you do that.
The estimating procedure is adjusted based on each bid that we get. The estimator looks at that and he analyzes why he was higher or lower. So he adjusts it in real time, but quarterly we adjust the inflation factors on the construction industry, which tend to run a little bit above normal inflation. So it's adjusted two ways, in real time as we see the numbers. So for example, in 2010, we were 14% higher than what the bids came in at. And in 2010, the numbers were going down. So there's a little bit of a lag in the information we get and our ability to adjust.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up on that then. If that, based on the way we see trends, is you read in the paper about how the economy is projected to go down, you know, and the percentages and all, so we almost know 6 months out that we may be getting a lower adjustment on inflation, for example, or some other terms, what I'm pointing. And
Do we factor that in, anticipating what's going to happen?
We don't, because we don't really know. And I don't know. We'd have to have some economist giving us that sort of level of detail. I don't know that it would add value to this. We're certainly within estimating ranges for the industry,
okay,
which are actually plus 30, minus 15.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we have a planning tool, and that tool is updated every time we get bids in terms of the new prices, the unit prices that are coming in every time we issue bids. And those unit prices are captured in this database, averaged, and they are then utilized by our planning staff to and our field operations to come up with estimates. But the key control point is your engineer's estimate. That is the point where you actually go out and call vendors, call suppliers, determining what unit actual unit prices are, and applying that against the quantities that you take from the plants. And that's how you form the engineer's estimate. That is not published. But the planning estimate, which is more general, that is taken from a database of prices that we get from all of these contracts.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up real quick on that. Do we identify ourselves when we call for estimates as VDOT calling?
Oh, yeah.
We do?
Yeah.
In other words, we're not comparing ourselves to the private sector, which may be getting a better rate when they think of dealing with the state as opposed to the private sector. I mean, it seems to me like it would be a blind call. You would go out and say, what is your cost on paving, your asphalt? What's your price on steel? Just as if I would be shopping around for something, I would be calling. I wouldn't be telling them that I'm with VDOT. And the automatic in the back of the mind is about a state price and private sector price. I think that we maybe need to look at that, making sure that we're getting our best prices being quoted back.
Understood.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry. I think Mr. Miller, Mr. Lane, then come back to Ms. Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Thomas, help me understand the differences, or why there's a difference in the presentation here. When we go to ballot threshold report, the 2 to 5 million, are those not in the 6-year plan? Because the six, here we have the 6-year plan number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When we go to the ballot threshold report, there's no such column.
This includes the total cost to construct the job with the construction engineering inspection costs as well.
And what I'm asking is, we have something to compare it to. You know, here we're saying, for example, on the Crittenden Bridge on primary on page 1,
mm-hmm,
the bid amount was 5.8. The 6-year plan number was 6.5.
Right. That includes all the costs.
So we can't compare that to 5.8?
No, you would look at the 5.3.
Okay, well, fine. We've got 5.3. Here we don't have anything. We just have a bid amount.
That may be a SAP project. I can get that for you.
I mean, it's helpful to sort of look at our 6-year plan number versus what the bid number was. Now, obviously, the other's FOIA protected and ought to be.
Yeah.
But it gives us some sense that we're doing better than our plan in one report. The other report, we have no idea. So my question was it in the six-year plan?
You should have all the bid results.
We had the bid results. Yeah. We didn't have the 6-year plan number.
We don't have a price to compare that bid.
All right.
Is what he's asking.
Makes sense.
That's an oversight. That should be in there.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Mr. Lane?
Mr.
Kuhlman.
Probably 3 years ago, some of you who were here then will remember I brought this point up, but I'd like to bring it up again because I do think the whole idea of blind estimates is really backwards looking. This is 2011. We're in information age. Everybody has access to commodity prices, labor rates, and so forth. And I'd like to just again suggest that at some point, if we develop a detailed estimate of any kind, that be shared right up front. It's transparent. People work down from that price, not up. What drives prices down isn't the fact that we have a secret number that they don't see. It's actually the competition that's in the marketplace that lets companies respond in real time to what they're capable of doing. And in the private sector, very often, if there's a number on the table and you know you have competition, you know, the instructions are, how do we beat that number? How do we get 10% under that number? How do we get lower than that number? So it just seems to fly in the face of the way the rest of the world works. You tell people what you want, you tell them the price you want to pay, and you're surprised at actually how people deliver. And I know that flies in the face of tradition and practice and so forth, but, you know, the after-the-fact comparison of our number with their number, you know, I won't show it to you. The tool you used, Commissioner, you know, they have the same kind of tools that they use. If you're in a bidding business, you really ratchet down those numbers based on what you win and what you don't win, and why didn't we get this? And, you know, I think it's something we ought to consider, is, you know, really opening the process up completely and letting people know exactly what our estimates are. The other thing is, I'm not sure the estimate works really for us separately from the bids we get. I mean, we have flexibility to accept bids under and over based on certain circumstances, so it's like a false, even the way we use it is kind of a false indicator of things. So if I'm just bringing it up that information is available to everybody, and the idea that we're withholding something because it's a secret, is it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. Don't have to do anything about it. Just
Mr. Rich. Mr. Rich, then with Ellis.
Can you please remind me, when these projects come in under bid, what happens to the extra money? Where do we put that back in the 6-year plan?
Mm-hmm.
Into a specific project, or
it just takes. Usually, the money doesn't go back in until that project's completely closed out, which is not during this process. It is the project's done, complete. There's no cost overruns, and the money's there, and it just finds its way back in through programming.
We reprogram it every year.
Right.
Money available.
Well, and again, remember, you're not really. You don't move money onto anything until you sign a contract and we start making payments. So there's not, as soon as it's in a 6-year plan, it doesn't mean we start setting money aside. Well, all we've done is we've allocated our expectation that we're going to be spending this money. It's not real. It's not until you sign that damn contract that we start to make payments through cash actually go out the door.
And eventually some will go back in.
No, it never went out. Never went out. Because all you've done is, the 6-year plan and our estimates are just simply, you got it, you think you have a certain revenue stream. We said we're going to use this revenue stream because it's based on so much per year, but it's even more complex than that because we constantly got money coming in and coming out. At any given moment, Mr. Worley, Mr. Lawson are sitting on probably a couple $1 billion, right?
They're going to
about $2 billion are sloshing around over there, and every time these contracts get awarded, they go in there and take a soup full and dish it out. But I mean,
it's not at all. It gets eventually reprogrammed.
Yeah, again, all we're doing is reallocating.
Reallocating. Yes.
It's all about liquidity.
What do you think, too, for putting in those numbers for contracts between 2 to 5? It helps you see what's going on in our district. Really, thank you
for that. Mr. Ellis.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I just want to make a note on Mr. Coolmay's comments about the sealed bid process. This is pretty much an industry standard procedure, you know, nationwide, you know, all, you know, states, you know, all, you know, private, you know, large contracts are pretty much issued, you know, in this format. So, you know, keep in mind, if the department is not like the number that comes in, they have the right to reject all bids, you know, at no reason at all, you know, and rebid it. So, you know, it's not something that's set in stone. You know, as far as the number that we're receiving, you know, if, you know, for some reason, you know, we don't like the numbers that come in. Plus, you know, if you give the industry your number, you've given away your competitive advantage. Because now they know, you know, what threshold we're going to try to meet, and most likely the number is going to come in at the number of the engineer's estimate, which it could have come in lower. So, you know, it's just ideas to think about.
Okay. So any other questions?
Thank you.
All right, we're on to new did we do the motion? We didn't do a motion.
Yeah, that's not really no action.
Okay. We have new business. I know, Mr. Keene.
I have a resolution of the Transportation Board to bring in form of a motion commending Gerald P. McCarthy. Whereas Gerald P. McCarthy was appointed to fill an unexpired term of the Commonwealth Transportation Board by Governor Mark Warner in July of 2002 and subsequently reappointed to full four-year terms by Governor Warner in 2003 and Governor Tim McCain in 2007. And whereas prior to representing the Richmond District, he compiled a record of dedicated and innovative service as a steward of the environment in state government, including serving on the Governor's Council on the Environment, where Governor Linwood Holton named him Executive Director in 1970. The successor body to the Governor's Council, the Council on the Environment, where he served as Chairman and Director, and the Virginian Environmental Endowment, where he still serves as Executive Director. And whereas his experience taught him the value of effective communication in bringing together disparate points of view to reach mutually beneficial consensus for the good of the Commonwealth as a whole, which he further promoted by spearheading creation of the University of Virginia's Institute for Environmental Negotiation to facilitate the wider use of conflict resolution tools. And whereas during his tenure on the board, he was an effective and thoughtful advocate for ways to spend taxpayer dollars more effectively, deliver environmentally conscious projects on time and on budget, and identify critical improvement projects locally and statewide to enhance economic development. And whereas his efforts were recognized by the Institute for the Environmental Negotiation, which made him the first recipient of the Gerald P. McCarthy Award for Leadership in Environmental Conflict Resolution, in recognition of his many contributions to the well-being of Virginia's endowment, including bringing environmental mediation to the Commonwealth. And whereas, as a result of his efforts, Virginia can continue to enjoy its position as a pioneer in developing and implementing effective solutions to improve the environment while preserving economic opportunities for its citizens. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Commonwealth Transportation Board extends its warmest regards and gratitude to Gerald P. McCarthy for his dedication and service to the Commonwealth of Virginia. Mr. Chairman, I bring this resolution in form of a motion.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much. Several items for new business from us. First is I just want to remind everybody of a couple things. The first is the transportation conference, the dates are December 7th through 9th. They'll be held over here at the Marriott downtown, over there at the waterside. We are going to have our CTB meeting in the morning. We'll make sure it's a short action agenda, and then we'll do this VTIP public meeting.
That'll be on the 7th.
That'll be on the 7th. So then also, that afternoon, several of the CTB members and the district administrators are going to be on a panel. And what we'd like to start doing is showcasing some of these bigger projects, noteworthy projects that might be happening in the districts. And tentatively, it's all being worked out, is the ones we'd like to highlight are the truck climbing lanes on 81, the hot lanes on 495, the Coalfields Expressway, the Coal Synergy Projects, the 295 Meadowville Interchange, and the Downtown Midtown Tunnel PPTA. Those are the ones we tentatively have right now. But what we'd like to do is again, we're just trying to find ways to get the CTB, make presentations there, and with the district administrators about some of the bigger projects happening in their districts. So I just want to give you a heads up. We'll be reaching out to everybody about those. But for those projects right now, we tentatively have in there, we're going to ask the district administrators and the CTB members to be up there and just essentially make short presentations about these projects. The next thing is that we will start, I mean, again, our process, constantly trying to improve our process, get public input, local government input, prior to the development of the six-year plan. Starting in a few weeks, starting October 3rd, we're going to be hosting a information meeting in every one of the districts. So, the primary folks are VDOT and BRPT, but we've asked that representatives from all the agencies that get money from the Commonwealth Transportation Fund to be there. So DMV, you can see aviation, you can see everyone there. This is an opportunity for us to go out to the community, start getting input up early, but also showcase some of the things that we're doing, as well as host, we're going to host a reception at the beginning for CTB members and staff and the local officials that have the opportunity to meet and talk. So hopefully everyone's gotten the dates for that. That's gone out to everyone. And we made sure everyone knows when these things. But it starts October 3rd in Lynchburg, October 4th in Abington, October 20th in Fredericksburg, October 24th in Chesapeake, October 25th in Fairfax, October 26th in Christiansburg, on November 2nd in Broadway, November 3rd in Culpeper, November 30th in Richmond. Okay? So just want to make sure everyone knows that, and that's going to be out there. I think as people seen from the press, we just received the conditional
approval to toll 95.
Provisional conditional approval to toll 95. That's just a major milestone that they've set aside one of the slots for the tolling pilot program for Virginia. And we still have to, you know, do all the necessary studies to move forward and actually tolling. I'm going to ask, is Mr. Worley, we have on the workshop in October a presentation about what that means, what we need to do, what the status of all those are.
Mr. Chairman, was it necessary to remove 81 in order to get 95?
Because under the law, only three states, three different interstates can veto. And so we obviously have had all these problems on 81. So as long as that 81 was kind of there, we could not move forward on 95. So we had to rescind the 81 in order to get 95. Yes,
Quick thing on that. Have we factored in, or will we factor in, what the impact of that might be on 81? Because as we all know, it provides an alternative
diversion
for people coming north going to Florida. And I fear that there's going to be a more of a traffic pattern shift over to 81 to avoid the tolls. And so even though we projected $50 million, will that be a true figure? And how do we determine how that can
really
shift and over what impact
that has? The various toll and revenue studies are going to show what types of diversion may occur, either local diversion or, you know, more bigger diversions like that. So these are all the issues, all the types of studies we're going to have to do and present them to this, to Federal Highway before we move forward. This one?
Yeah, just today, I got the call from the press here before it went in the newspaper. Did we send out, when we get those in the future, could we send out a little notice?
I got
blindsided by it. I didn't get that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, this is where issues get issued by the governor's office. Okay. So this was not a VDOT release. This was a governor's release. So, but we should have gotten it out. It was one of those things. There's two things. I'm going to ask Mr. Worley. There's an article today about the Route 29 bypass and about estimates. I've asked Mr. Worley to kind of walk through the issue on estimates and what estimates are being bandied about. But before we do that, we wanted to give a presentation to the board about Hurricane Irene emergency response. Just to tell folks the work that was done, who's going to come up and do that presentation?
Dwayne and John Jacobs.
Dwayne and John Jacobs, come on up.
Hi.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, good morning and welcome to Hampton Roads. I'm the district maintenance engineer for Hampton Roads, John Jacobs, and this is the regional operations director, Dwayne Cook. And what we're going to give is a brief, 10-minute briefing, information briefing on Hampton Roads and Hurricane Irene. The agenda we have is three major points. I will present the first one, and then Dwayne Cook will present the second and third in terms of the discussion. When we go into an event, emergency response, we have three main points. One, to have a very efficient and effective emergency response, which in essence, as you see in the orange, is managed information. That's 50% of emergency response is properly managing information, so you get the right thing at the right place doing the right operation. Also, you want to have a response momentum right from the get-go. Third, you want to have people know what they're doing, when they're doing it, and cross-leveling. We base our response at the district level on an area command. It comes back from the National Incident Management System. We use as the base document is the Coast Guard Incident Management Handbook, a very good document. And what we created from that is translating it to a field operating guide that translates it to a transportation focus within our district. The organization we use is shown here. Now, at first glance, you're going to sit there and go, there's 14 direct reports to an area commander. In this case, it was myself and Dwayne Cook were the area commanders. But the intent of an area command is overview from a strategic level of the incident management teams that are actually doing the work. And you make sure you have good, solid leaders in those incident commander positions at the residencies and at the facilities so that at the area command, you provide overall strategy and manage critical resources. And looking at this organization, you'll see on the left side is all the incident management teams. We have the three residencies within the district, Accomack, Franklin, and Williamsburg. We organize all our river crossing, the tunnels, and all movable bridges into one incident management team. And then we have the interstate, and we had a debris removal for the region, and we have structure and bridge. Those are the incident commanders that are doing the work. The rest of the area command is planning sections and logistics. We coordinate and make sure that they're successful at their job. This is when we activate an area command, basically a regional impact, and where we have incidents, the incident managers may be competing for the same resources, at which point both Dwayne and I and the area command staff prioritize the critical resources and prioritize the incidents. One of the key strengths that the agency has is the ability to move resources across the state to an area that's impacted. Specifically, we moved highway emergency response teams predominantly from the I-81 corridor, Stanton, and Northern Virginia, to Hampton Roads. It was critical. It really was a plus up. We had a total of 76 people shown here from the various different districts that came to assist us, and they all showed up prior to storm tropical force winds came into the area. So we had the resources on the ground ready to go once the storm cleared. Now I turn it over to Dwayne.
Thank you, John, and good morning to all of you. As John mentioned, 50% of the work is managing the information. There's a lot of data that's out there, so how do you take that information and make it useful so you can manage your resources and your response to the effort? So we use a lot of data. A lot of our sources are statewide calls with VDEM, within VDOT, with the port locally, as well as within our area command, to get a common operating picture of what's going on, what's coming up ahead of us, and what resources are needed in different areas. We also use a variety of open source data that you are all familiar with, the NOAA resources, some of the local weather channels, as well as websites, information like that. And we also have some of our own sensors at different locations to kind of ground truth what the forecast or predicted information is going to be. The I mentioned one there, the emergency management software HERVAC. You see that on the next page. That's a screen capture. And essentially this tool helps visualize the advisories that come out of the National Hurricane Center. So you can anticipate in advance when the onset of tropical storm force winds or hurricane force winds may be impacting your area. So that's a visual tool. One of the other open source tools that we use, you see here, this is a NOAA site. The red line in this case is historical, showing where the stage of the Elizabeth River was at the Midtown River, but this also is a predictive tool that is black in the prediction area and red fills in behind it. So this allows us to know in advance when we might have flood levels, and this is just a particular incident. We monitor this for the Jamestown Scotland Ferry as well as our other TOMA facilities. In advance of the hurricane, we do a lot of preparatory activities. Some of them are listed here. Deploy dewatering pumps, special high-capacity pumps to dewater the tunnels if necessary. Test the tide gates, relocate the ferries to the deepwater port in Richmond. And that last one there, I'm going to come back to it, but also start kind of an army of efforts with public outreach to keep the public informed what's going to be happening, what we anticipate to be happening with the transportation network, and not only traditional news release media interviews, but also now with a lot of social media outreach. You see here an example of one of those efforts. We put flyers in the hands of all the ferry users well in advance of moving the ferry to let them know they're going to have to make some alternative plans, that isn't going to be available for them to use at the specified time. From the post-storm recovery, we had a lot of successes. Fortunately, Hurricane Irene was not the storm that it was predicted. It did cause some troubles, but not the level that we anticipated. But it also did come during the same time frame that we had an earthquake and a follow-on tropical storm with Lee that created a lot of flooding. So we were able to open all the interstates and primaries by Sunday afternoon. The tunnels were reopened Sunday. Some of the efforts are ongoing, as you see there, but also I've highlighted in orange that these orange efforts were kind of pre-event efforts to cut task orders in regards to having instruments in place to manage the debris collection and reduction and do some repair work to our facilities. One I specifically want to point out is that we also pre-purchased 250 10-second live radio slots. You know, when people lose power, they don't have their TV, but they go to the radio. So we can plug in at any time and give a 10-second live update of what's going on and to inform the public. And I think that's very critical, specifically looking at the last bullet there about documenting lessons learned and getting better each time we go through this. I remember back in Hurricane Floyd, at our Transportation Operations Center, we had tables set up very much like you see here for your board meeting, and we had people and phones at all of those. As a department, we've established a customer service center to manage a lot of that response, but during that event, we had phones and people, and you couldn't put the phone down without it ringing and someone picking up. So this media outreach is a lesson learned, and the customer service center helps us meet the needs of the public. That's a very brief overview, and if you have any questions, John and I will be happy.
Mr. Worley.
Members of the board, I wanted to have this presentation today just to say that these guys did a great job in the Hampton Roads area, and also our other districts. This was not a statewide presentation, but what you see here is what you pretty much see in all of our district operations. And it's the organization that gets you through an event like this. You just can't come in unorganized and think you're going to respond. These guys have a plan. They executed their plan, and they adjusted where we needed to. And you'll find that happens pretty much throughout all of our districts. And the point that I also want to reference is that when you look at our other districts like Stanton and who weren't faced with that event, they had their staff here working and also in other districts. So it was a team effort. This was Hampton Roads presenting today, but what you see as Hampton Roads is presented, you'll see largely duplicated in our other districts as their events happen in those areas.
Yeah,
I just want to second what Mr. Woolley said and also point out what Dwayne did about the communications. I don't think I've ever seen it any better in terms of letting people know when the tunnel may close and communicating. I mean, I've heard that in various meetings I've been through, how much better and how well that was received by the community. I will once mention one thing. The governor gave an update about what was going on, and he mentioned the flooding at the Midtown Tunnel. Of course, what he mentioned, what he meant to say was where it normally accumulates, we close the floodgates and it accumulated, and we had to pump it out there. Warren got on after he spoke and really explained it well so that the panic sort of went down, the level went down, that the tunnel actually wasn't flooded, but the entranceway was. So anyway, that was interesting because the phone started ringing once the tunnel flooded, but it really wasn't flooded. It did exactly what it was supposed to do, and Warren Hansen did a great job of explaining.
Although they did create a great swimming pool.
Yeah.
Mr. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, this situational awareness page that you presented, you know, that's what I was talking about earlier. The ability to share information as opposed to keep information from one another is really the hallmark of our time. The better you share it, the better everybody can use it, the better everybody can understand what the possibilities are. I had a question specifically about the software. Is that a software that's shared by all the jurisdictions in Virginia or up and down the East Coast, or is it a... is it something that's proprietary to
No, that RVAC is a software that most public entities or emergency managers, they can register and get a copy of that.
Okay, so you're basically working from a common platform then.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
That's good. And then finally, the coordination in advance for this type of incident is really important, but it turned out to be a fairly predictable event. I mean, what you thought would happen, happened. Isn't the challenge really when things happen that you don't expect to happen? And how do you, is that, if something unexpected happens, do you have access to everybody else's resources? For example, the way,
yes,
Commissioner,
yes,
you moved plows from other parts of the state into Northern Virginia when we had the big snowstorm.
Actually, if you look at it, we expected a lot worse.
Yeah.
In Hampton Roads area,
yes,
that didn't materialize, but we had more damage in other areas, and we did not expect to have that amount of damage into the other areas. So we mobilized our teams from either Stanton or Culpeper, and we brought them in to assist those other districts. Now, we had staffed up and pre-positioned a number of teams in the Hampton Roads area, in anticipation of a major, major event. And when that didn't materialize, we were able to move our resources around.
And as the Commissioner stated, this is a statewide effort, but it's also, it wasn't used specific for this event, based on national directive and policy and guidance. It's an all-hazards approach. If you go back to the storms of last winter, the storms affected different areas in different ways than what we anticipated, and throughout the event, we were able to reposition resources, as the Commissioner stated, from different places in the state to meet that response, to meet that
need. We do have an all-hazards approach to emergency management, mm-hmm, and there is some statewide policy guidance and practice around that, and we have practiced over many years. And we do have standing teams, and for all different kinds of things, from signal teams to tree teams to bridge repair teams, and they know who they are, and you know, on a moment's notice, they're available to travel. So you know, we partner with, you know, Dominion Power, for example, and other utility companies that we need to be able to go in when we have problems with down power lines and things like that. But it is something that we spend a lot of time on, emergency management and working with our partners, and we have to action reviews as well to continuously have learnings that, you know, we put into practice.
Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Great job.
Thank you.
Commissioner.
Mr. Secretary, members of the board, I asked the Secretary to let me address the board regarding an article, and I guess it was Charlottesville Tomorrow, and it was on the Route 29 cost. And the article suggests that we underestimated the cost and didn't provide that information to the CTB. And I want to address that issue. We asked our Culpeper staff to develop an estimate for the Route 29. They did that. We did not give them a target. We didn't tell them what the amount of money should be. We just said, please develop an estimate for a project for Route 29. That is what we call the planning estimate. That is the estimate you typically see in a six-year program. That number for every project, those numbers come from our district operations. Just like other projects, that number was included in the six-year program. We were FOIA'd by a group in the Culpeper District asking for any information relative to Route 29 project. That FOIA request disclosed a memorandum from one of our engineers in the central office that said he had concern with the estimate, the planning estimate that was to be included in the six-year program. I reviewed that estimate and I asked several questions. The questions that I asked was one, how did we determine the estimate? The answer was the estimate was based upon a set of plans that were developed years ago. My next question is that the project you plan to build? The answer was no, that's probably not the project we plan to build. Therefore the estimate that was quoted from that in the paper and from that memorandum was not an official estimate for the project that the Culpeper District was planning. There are two or three points that causes a difference between those estimates. One was the end points of that project was over-designed or over-engineered. The Culpeper staff was looking at ways to minimize that design. That was a factor included in developing their estimate. The estimate from the central office did not try to figure out how do you streamline those two endpoints, but rather priced the plans as they existed. So that's on both ends, the north end and the south end. Then there's another factor, which would be the cut going through the mountain. The elevation is a key to the cost there. I think ASHTO standards allow an elevation between a grade of 4 and 6. And I think the estimate in the central office was looking at more of a grade of 4. And I think the grade in the Culpeper District was probably a higher grade. That was another change or factor that influenced the cost. So looking at those things, I felt that the engineer in the Culpeper District was closer to the project we planned to build, and that was the probably the correct estimate. I also felt that that is our normal process. When we include numbers in the six-year plan, it comes from the district and not the central office. Now, the discussion we had earlier today about the engineer's estimate, typically when the central office becomes involved is when you are developing the engineer's estimate. That estimate is confidential. That estimate is exempt from FOIA. So what that paper or email that the reporter got was not an official estimate. But to me, it was good. I looked at it. It helped me try to figure out what would be the appropriate cost. And I responded to that email that I received and said there are these three factors that I laid out, the cost on both ends, the cut going through the mountain. And the other point was that our typical estimates have been coming in about 15% on the average below what we've been estimating. And then there's another point that I responded to that email. And none of this made the newspaper, by the way. I responded that we also want to use the creativity of the private sector to help us design this project. Now, when we put this RFP out for bid, the designs will be as a guide. The bidder does not have to follow those designs. They are there for a reference only. And we're including some other documents for reference only because we want the contractor to, or bidder, to bring his creativity to the table, and just maybe they can find a better way, a transportation solution for that area, and at a lower cost. And I referenced 495. If you look at that project, when we estimated that project internally, we were taking a number of homes, adding a four lane, taking a number of homes and a cost of about $3 billion. When we got the private sector involved with some of their creativity, we ended up only taking eight homes and a cost of about $1.5 billion. So that's what I meant by the creativity and letting the private sector go. So I wanted to make certain that the board knew that I was not trying to hide any numbers from the board. I have no reason to do that. But that article gave the impression that we were withholding data from the board, and I didn't take that lightly, so I asked the secretary if I could address the board. I still believe that the estimate at this point is a reasonable one. Do I believe that that estimate could the bids come in over that? Yes. Could the bids come under that? Yes. And I hope that's not by a material amount. But that's what we have as a planning estimate, and that's pretty much a summary of the audit.
Any questions, Mr. Rich?
I appreciate the commissioner's discussion with us. As you all know, this is sitting here in my district. I've been concerned about this process from day one. When you bring out a 20-year-old project and try to resurrect it, and we right now don't know the outlines of how this project would be designed. It's just kind of floating out there. When you look at it initially, the cost, I think, what was it, Commissioner? $120 million to build the road without the interchange. It would not make sense on its face. You have to remove Stillhouse Mountain and all the other problems involved with this project. This board should know what central office is saying. We should be briefed that maybe there's a range here because we can't represent the taxpayers properly without having all the information, and I don't think we had all the information. We had talked earlier about this infrastructure bank, how we'll never let politics get involved. We're always going to do the right thing. We're always going to base it on the right financial data, which I don't think we had in this case. You're going to see this project way up. We were supposed to base it on the right engineering data. In this case, as I say, I'm not sure that we have the right financial data when we voted for this. The engineering data on a study that we paid for.
Mr. Chairman, this is a point of order.
I'm not finished yet. Carson said that this project does not serve a transportation purpose. So we don't have the financial data correct.
Okay,
we don't have the technical data. So I continue to be very disturbed, and this is sucking all the air out of our district with all the other projects that we need. And I just continue to be quite concerned about this project.
Dr. Davis.
My point of order was whether we were debating the issue of a decision we previously made or whether my colleague was making a speech.
Okay.
I gather it was making a speech.
Listen, the only thing I just would add to this is when this issue first came up, we asked specifically just how much this would cost internally. And no one had any influence on any of the numbers. I mean, the numbers that were presented were the numbers that were presented to me and within the administration. It's essentially what the board did a couple months ago was we allocated a certain amount of the six-year plan. We've not spent any money, let's say, except for this preliminary work on doing the RFP. No money's been spent. The actual, when you go out for an RFP for design build, they're going to come back with various bids. We're going to see how much this thing costs. Personally, I still am a little shocked that 6.5 miles of road will cost $200 million. I think that it should come in dramatically less. But I got to tell you something right now. This is from my standpoint, being in this position for 18 months. There has to be a cultural shift in VDOT about these issues on costs, because I've seen it over and over and over again. I look and say, okay, in fact, this just came up. Mr. Kilpatrick knows about what I'm talking about. I point out a transportation problem. They go, oh, we designed an $80 million fix. And I go, well, we don't have it. What is it, in 6 years? No. Well, what can we do in between? I mean, they designed the fix, the engineering solution, and then say we got to, instead of looking at how much money we got, and what can we do with that money? And I think, you know, anyone who's ever been through the Springfield Interchange, I'm sorry, I look at that and I go, you got to be kidding me. All right, the cost that went into that, and I realize if people can still zoom around 50, 60 miles an hour on those ramps, but I looked at the, you know, I was on the TPB up in Washington on the 495 project, and I got to tell you, I remember being shocked. They were going to take 350 homes. They're going to knock down the brand new Capital One headquarters. They were going to, and that was only in two lanes. And at a cost of $3 billion, the P3 partners come in for half the price and four lanes. It took eight houses and not a single commercial property. There has to be sometimes these issues on cultural change, and maybe I'm a little jaundiced because I've been seeing this stuff, but, you know, Mr. Worley and all them, they gave us this number. We've allocated the numbers. We're going to see what the bids come back. This board will then have the opportunity to make that decision whether it makes sense to go forward with this project, given what's going on. Personally, when I look at this project, this is not Southwest Virginia. I'm sitting there going, we can build more of this, the Coalfields Expressway up in the mountains than what was presented for $500 million for what was originally designed for this 29 bypass. So, but the board, the estimates, everyone followed this, the normal process. There's internal stuff, you know, and with the numbers, all those numbers that some people are kicking around, this board will have the opportunity to make that final decision like it normally does as to whether to move forward with the project. All we've done is we set aside or at least allocated a certain amount of money towards this project, but no contract's been awarded, no official estimate's been developed, and we don't really know what the private sector is going to come in with for a design build on this thing.
Mr. Chairman, what exactly are we putting out to the private sector to bid on?
Essentially putting in a design build for a four-lane divided highway. We know where the start point is. We know where the end point is.
And that's it. It's still, they have to design it all.
Yes, yeah, that's what the design builds
do. Do we usually use the design build process for this big of a project?
Sure. Well, actually, another crazy thing about this great organization my commissioner often hears me about is a design build is supposed to be a design build. All right? We go out to design build after we design 30%, right? That's not a design build. That's a design bid build. So we've got to get VDOT back there. We're going to go bring the private sector in like we did with 495 and save money and better designs and more mobility and let the private sector come in and do it. Don't do 30% of the design and then say it's a design build. This is going to be one of those first occasions, well, not first, but it's going to be an occasion where we're going to let the private sector know this is the right-of-way. We want a four-lane divided road that starts here, ends there. You tell us how to do it and how much it's going to cost.
Secretary, Mr. Rick, we have reviewed, we're in process of completing our review of the RFP with the Federal Highway, and we're reviewing all of the requirements with them. I am hopeful to review the RFP maybe Friday or Monday. But at this point, all indications from Federal Highway that we've met all of the requirements, to do this as a design bill. But we will include the old plans that we have, and we'll attach them to the contract, to the RFP. Not that the designer must follow those, but they're just reference. We will also put in all the ASHTO specifications that they would have to meet, and that those are the requirements that we would have in the RFP.
What kind of standards are we sending out? Is it going to be designed to an interstate highway, or all of those we have to give them?
Yeah, we will put that in the RFP. All that will be in the RFP.
I'd like if you all could sit down with me and kind of go over this. I've just felt left out of this whole process, and this thing is sitting in my district. And whether or not we have to tell the whole board, or if you could sit down with the board member and where this project is located and let us know these internal numbers, I don't want to have to FOIA my own agency to get enlightened information about ranges. I just feel really kind of let down by this entire process, and the taxpayers in my district, I really do.
Any further questions, Ms. Worley? We did make a mistake. I'm not as dumb as I look. We did have to have a vote on one of these contracts. So, I'm sorry. This was the maintenance contracts. We actually do need the
We had to vote.
So
yeah, apologies. My astute colleagues picked up on my mistakes. I need approval on $5.8 million for Project 86078, which is paving in Isle of Wight County. And I also need to affirm the award of the $31 million for the design bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, thank you very much. All right, now we're not officially adjourning because we're going to luncheon, then we're going out on the tour. So we'll adjourn right before the first drink at Mr. Miller's. And we'll also know that the luncheon is right next door.
The lunch is right across the hall in the Admiral.
Okay.
Leave books in here.
Leave all this here for right now.
No.
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 No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No